This episode of the Rick Emerson Show is made possible by our good friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
We're all very different people. We're not Watusi. We're not Spartans. We're Americans with a capital A, huh? You know what that means? Do you? That means that our forefathers were kicked out of every decent country in the world. We are the wretched refuse. We're the underdog. We're mutts. Here's proof. His nose is cold. But there's no animal that's more faithful, that's more loyal, more lovable than the mutt. Who saw Old Yeller? Who cried when Old Yeller got shot at the end? Nobody cried when Old Yeller got shot, I'm sure. I cried my eyes out. So we're all dog faces. We're all very, very different, but there is one thing that we all have in common. We were all stupid enough to enlist in the Army. We're mutants. There's something wrong with us. Something very, very wrong with us. Something seriously wrong with us. We're soldiers, but we're American soldiers. We've been kicking ass for 200 years. We're 10 and 1. Now, we don't have to worry about whether or not we've practiced. We don't have to worry about whether Captain Stillman wants to have us hung. All we have to do is to be the great American fighting soldier that is inside each one of us. Now, do what I do and say what I say. And make me proud.
It is 24 minutes after the hour of one, and this, the month of November in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along and making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. Thank you for joining us on this Thursday. It is Thursday, and welcome to day 12. From high atop the milk packing district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, the home of all good things, it's the Rick Emerson cavalcade of amusements and whimsy. It's 503-505-6964 if you would like to join us today. The great unturning of the phones happens... Wait now. There we go. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964 if you would like to join us with your comments, questions, clarifications, musings of an ironic nature, ponderings, recipes, perhaps tips on how to rid your garden of boll weevils, you know, or whatever. Or maybe you want to explain why it's called a bell jar when the jar says ball on the front of it. If you'd like to do any of those things, you can do it at 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick at rickemerson.com. Rick at rickemerson.com. Dawn Taylor can be reached at Dawn, D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com. Also, you can get in the text box at rickemerson.com. You should click live chat. You can also go to Skype, Rick Emerson Show, do any of those things. You can have your man come by and pass along his message to me if you'd like. You could send some sort of a, maybe a burro weighted down with a rucksack inside.
Carrier pigeon?
A carrier pigeon, sure.
A dog with one of those special little outfits that they put on them so they can carry things for
I think they just carry
people.
They carry vodka, I think, is what you're... Oh, you're talking about not with the thing, but with the other deal.
Yeah, they have like whole little like jackets they wear that have pockets so they can carry all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, whenever I see a homeless guy carrying one of those, you know, and he's got one of the dogs behind him on a lead and the dog is weighted down with all the homeless guy's crap... you know, I always wonder why I, at that moment, am not carrying a pair of shears with which I can free the dog and have him live a life anew somewhere else where he's not weighted down by the objects of a smelly gutter punk downtown. But, you know, it's a conversation for another day. It's 503-505-6964. Here's what's coming up today. We got your penis watch. We got your taser watch. We got your... Sometimes I sound like a carnival barker. Come on inside. We got your penis watch, your taser watch. You, little girl, what do you like? Corpses? Boy, do we have corpses. Corpses by the dozen. Your corpse watch coming up today. Come on. Step right up. Win some crap. Penis watch, taser watch, corpse watch. Oh, my. Also, columnist Anna Griffin from the Oregonian going to be in the studio with us later on. We're going to be up to our eyeballs in Oregonians here because we got Anna Griffin coming in, then we got Mr. Mike Russell, who reviews films for the Oregonian, as well as authoring a Culture Pulp, which is a comic, but also a website, but also, I don't know, a way of life, an outlook, a philosophy. You can find out more about Mike Russell at culturepulp.com. You've probably heard he's on with Corden Fatboy a lot. He's been on the show before. He is the author of any number of fine pieces about American cinema and other facets of our popular culture. So you can find out more about that. Culturepulp.com. He's going to be on later on the day talking about, among other things, a big three-part interview he did with Bloom County creator Berkeley Breathed, which is awesome, by the way. Which I urge you to read in like the strongest possible terms. So if you get a chance to read that, you can find it at culturepulp.com. So that's all coming up later on. We also have another installment of the greatest songs ever made. That's coming up within the next half hour or so. So coming up sometime in the next hour, greatest songs ever made. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian after that. Mike Russell after that. Penis Watch, Taser Watch, Corpse Watch, and Don Taylor, who is tracking the following headlines for you on this Thursday.
Critics and audience are not amused by Conan's belly aching. Bastard. A Pennsylvania man lights a joint to celebrate the birth of his child. And an Orlando theme park promises to keep the noise down.
Okay. That is all in the way, plus, I don't know, other things. This is, we were talking about this before the show, that we have other stuff to get to, but at this point, the show is already just coming apart at the virtual seams.
How much?
I mean, really, the cream of our engineering and architectural acumen right now is going into creating some sort of an underpinning for the show that can contain the massive amount of entertainment that threatens to just burst forth like some sort of explosive cornucopia of fun at any moment.
I think that explains why it is so swelteringly hot in this room. Is because of just the sheer amount of entertainment we're trying to keep contained in this room.
You know, here's the thing, is what's happening right now is that in this room, entertainment molecules are rubbing up against each other. So overfull is this program with fun, Don. See, that's the thing. It's like on certain programs, what are you gonna do? Well, I got this one moderately amusing anecdote I'm gonna tell later on, and then perhaps a bawdy story. And then, you know, and that's it. And then you know, the rest of the time is just a guy going like, so anyway, and then just scratching himself and pulling lint out of his navel. How much fun is there to be had there? Not very much.
No.
So the molecules are in a relatively stationary position. They don't rub up against each other, hence no friction, no convection, no heat. Here, this is like this show at any given moment, but especially today, but I mean really pretty much all the time. And if you're listening, you know this. I mean, I'm selling past the close, as they say. If you're listening to this show in terms of just sheer compelling zing...
Yeah.
It's like a Jiffy Pop. The moment before it explodes, the moment before Dad just touches the knife to the top of it, and it goes, and it just it pours forward kernels of joy. That's really what that's what the show is like at this very moment. Dawn, listen to all this fun I've got right here.
That's a lot of fun. Wow, that's a whole stack of fun.
It's a pile of fun.
I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Can we not make radio this much fun with the door open so that maybe we could get some air in here? Or would you be unable to make radio with the door actually
Here's the thing about to make radio. Somebody has to go make water?
Something like that.
All right. Well, here's the thing is that you all have been saying that it's a little hot in here. And I'm not really feeling that, but that's okay. You know, it's one of our thermostats is obviously different. I'm willing to admit that I'm probably the odd man out here. Because Sarah and Greg, We did the show yesterday. We get off the air. You had to take up to do Ham-Fisted Radio. And how did that go, by the way?
Oh, it was delightful.
Excellent. So you can hear that at hamfistedradio.com if you like. So I'm sitting in the kitchen afterward, and I'm doing some work, and the door is shut, but the way we often do it here, just so you people at home know, because occasionally we get somebody that email us, and they want to know, like, the behind the scenes or the sort of behind the curtain, how everything operates, and, you know, like, what kind of microphones do you use? By the way, the answer to that question is the Electro Voice RE20, the finest vocal transducer known to man. Mm-hmm. So there's a studio door, then across the hall is this sort of green room / kitchen / break room, you know, whatever. And there's a door there as well. And so sometimes we will have both of those doors shut so that the people in the studio, you know, aren't bothering whoever's in the kitchen, and the people who are in the kitchen aren't bothering whoever's on the air. But I didn't have them shut yesterday. I just had the studio door. So I'm in there hearing Greg and Sarah, and I can kind of hear them doing the show a little bit like this. And it's like, I'm not 5 seconds into the kitchen when I hear Sarah announce loudly to Greg, and presumably to the audience, male and otherwise, that she just has to strip off a lot of her clothing because it's way too hot in here. And it's like, if you listen really closely, you could just hear the sound of a lot of geeks going and just leaning closer to their monitor somehow as they were listening at home. But she said it was kind of warm. Greg said it was kind of warm. You're saying it. I can see that it's a little cozy in here right now. It's a...
Yeah, no, I'm just...
I don't find it smotheringly hot, but I'll tell you what. During the break, I will go have speaks with the office manager. Be like.
Yeah, because when we did the changeover this morning, when Sarah and Greg opened the door, the first thing Sarah did was she just came to the kitchen and was panting like a dog and going, it's so hot in there.
You just take great gulps of life-giving crisp oxygen from the...
Because it is really icy, icy cold outside. It was like 40-something degrees outside. And in this studio, it's like 85.
All right, I will tell you this, actually. So I just opened the drape right here, which I never do. I try to leave the curtains shut to avoid any of the hateful, hideous sun from streaming in. Mm. I just opened the curtains, and I just felt the window, and I will grant you that the window itself is warm. And so since it's, you know, not quite officially wintertime, but it's cold, it was like 39 or something last night, that indicates it probably is pretty warm in here if the window itself is warm. All right. I will speak with, I'll talk with Donna.
Thank you.
I'll talk to Bob.
If nothing else, maybe we could just close the vent that has the heat coming in.
See, the thing is, I don't think there's any... This is the last thing I'll say about it, because then we're just going to... I didn't see Conan last night, so I don't know what the nature of the belly aching was. Was he complaining about something?
Yes.
So it wasn't like an actual stomach ache. That's not a clever play on words that a newspaper read.
No, it's about complaining.
Okay, so I don't want to be that guy. I'm just going to say, I'm not entirely sure that they actually have the heat on this floor is the thing. This is what we determined yesterday. It's not even that they have the heat turned on up here, because we're the only residents of this floor. It's that they have the heat turned on directly below us, and they do not have... In other words, the ventilation system up here is in neutral, basically. It's not doing anything.
Yeah.
So it's not heating, but it's not really cooling. Because if you go into the rest of this floor where we are, you know, it's fairly crisp. I mean, it's cool. Not cold, but cool.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's the thing, is they're not even really heating this floor. They're just not cooling this room. This room is hotter than the rest of this floor because we're directly above a room where the heat is going full blast. So I'm just saying, closing the vent is not going to help. In fact, we'd need the vent open if they turned on the cool air. So maybe they'll do that.
Okay.
And it's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. So, yes, Anna Griffin coming up. Mike Russell coming up. We got your Taser watch. We got your corpse watch. We got your penis watch. We got your greatest songs ever made. And we have more observations about, boy, it's sure hot. You remember when it was cold? It's not like now when it's hot. And, you know, how things used to cost a nickel, which had bumblebees on them, and, you know, which were called bumbles at the time. Hello, Don Taylor. How was your night? Here's the thing. I don't want to put you in a bad frame of mind.
Yeah.
But have you considered... Now, I'm not saying this is the case. I didn't mean to ask you a question and then interrupt you, but it just occurred to me. Because I know where you're going a little bit with what you did last night. Has it occurred to you that Sarah is a little bit sick, Greg is a little bit sick, Patrick is a little bit sick, you might be a little bit sick, I'm fine... To me, the room feels normal. To all y'all, it feels too warm.
I'm not a little bit sick. And honestly, I can tell the difference. You walk out of this room, walk out into the hall or the kitchen, and you can see the difference in temperature. It's that if I was sick, I would just be warm everywhere.
You can see the difference in temperature?
You can feel the difference.
In here, you're just seeing dead relatives. All right.
I mean, you know, if I was sick, if I was feeling warm because I'm sick, I would feel warm everywhere. I wouldn't just feel warmer in this room than in another room.
And the pupil becomes the teacher. Well done.
Thank you.
How's Patrick? Is he vomiting?
He actually did this morning.
Oh, yeah, I feel bad. I was just saying that because I thought he didn't.
No, he's had this thing where he was like, Because he's one of those things. What he does is, in lieu of going to a doctor, he talks to me about it. So it's like he went through this period where he had a headache for a couple of days. I have a headache. I'm like, well, where is it? Right behind my eyes. Well, you have a sinus headache. Well, what do we do about that? Well, you take sinus headache stuff. Have you used the neti pot to, like, clean out your sinuses? No, because he hates doing this. Okay. So then, like, the next day, I still have a headache. You have a sinus headache. Go get some sinus medicine and take. Do you want me to go to Walgreens and get you some? No, I'll do it. Day three. I feel really bad. I'm, like, tired. I have pink eye. You know, I don't know what he did, but he rubbed one of his eyes, and his eye was all red for, like, 2 days. I don't feel sick. I'm like, well, apparently you have a cold or something.
What are the other symptoms of pink eye? Like, do you know he doesn't have pink eye?
I'm pretty sure. I think, well,
I've never had that, so I don't know what it is.
I think when somebody truly has pink eye, because it's some kind of, like, a bacterial infection.
Right, yeah.
So your eye actually swells up, and all the skin around it gets pink.
Okay, all right.
This was just that he rubbed his eye.
So he's just got cold and flu symptoms.
Right, and but it's like every day it's something.
Oh, no,
and
I feel terrible today. Worse than yesterday.
So this morning it's like, you know, he goes out. He goes, oh, you just missed it. I was just throwing up. It's like, yeah, I did miss that.
It was Technicolor.
And like, so since have you thought maybe you might, it's possible, you know, there might be something like actually seriously wrong with you, since he's now finding that every time he like eats, he's been slightly nauseous for several days, and if he eats dairy products, he starts throwing up. He goes, maybe I'm lactose intolerant all of a sudden. I'm going, well, no, you don't. Yeah. So, yeah. But God knows he's not going to actually go to a doctor and talk to a doctor or just shut up about it. It's just this constant kind of...
Yeah, going to the doctor at this point is probably just like a net loss unless they'll give him some of that, you know, like just some speed to clear out his nose or whatever. Like that's the only... if you have the flu or the cold or whatever now, the only reason to go to a doctor is so they'll give you Sudafed so you can breathe.
Yeah.
Because if you get that whole like... where it's like your nose is just clogged, that's it. Because what are they... You know, if you go to a doctor with a cold... they're going to tell you the same thing you probably tell them. Just like, shut up, just man up, yeah, and be quiet and have some liquids or whatever it is you're supposed to do.
Yeah, I bought some Alka-Seltzer cold medicine. I gave him some of that.
Oh, I love that stuff.
Last night, I was just like, before we went to bed, I was like, okay, the neti pot is in there. It's already got the saline and the warm water in it. Use it right now.
And so he's got the congestion going on.
He doesn't really have congestion, but he's had like a sinus headache for like going along with this for days. So it doesn't hurt to like... clean out the sinuses.
So is he thinking, are you thinking on his behalf, as is probably accurate and, you know, improper, are you thinking that he's got the sinus buildup in his head, which is why he's got the sinus headache?
Possibly, yeah.
Because I had that a few years back, and it's horrible.
A little bit of
horrible.
Nasty crap did come out when he did
It's horrible. I have to tell you, that having the sinus headache is one of the worst pains I have ever had in my life. I mean, to the point that I was like, I was convinced something awful was wrong with me, something horrible. And it was, I think it was like, I don't think we had insurance at the time either, because I think Laura was still in school, and I was doing something. I was working for some radio station that didn't see fit to actually, you know, I wasn't valuable enough to actually keep me from dying or whatever. So I didn't have insurance, this is how you know it hurt, because I actually, and I'm such a tightwad, I actually pried loose a little bit of money from my wallet and just, you know, creaked it open and went to the doctor. And I said, I got this terrible headache. It's the worst headache in the history of my life. And she's doing that thing of like, shining a light in my eyes, and she goes, you know, does this hurt? And like, ah, you know, she beams like a little pen light into my eyes. And then she said, well, tilt your head side to side. And I went, okay, left, right, whatever. And she said, okay, does it make almost like a sloshing kind of a sensation? And I said, yes. And she said, oh, God, okay, I thought you had a tumor for a second. And apparently, like, she honestly, it's like I have a chain of doctors who just say, like, the worst things to me. The one guy tells me I'm not getting any younger, and the other guy is like, well, you know, you can never tell, it might kill you. And then she's saying, like, I thought you had a tumor. But apparently the symptoms and the pain caused by a sinus buildup in your head is exactly the same as that caused by a tumor. And so she gave me the, well, this is what you're suggesting, though. It wasn't the neti pot as such, but it was the, you know, the bottle of, like, saline thing.
Yeah.
You just go, and you just, like, it's like the ocean, whatever, and you just spray it into your nose. And then she did give me, like, some antibiotics or whatever that, like, liquefied. And she told me, she's like, you don't want to use this right before you have meals or anything. And I said, oh, really? Does it interfere with digestion? She goes, no, but it grosses everybody out. And if they're trying to eat, that's not going to work. Because I swear to God, like, I would just be sitting around going, like, so, You know, anyway, so then I said, there's three of us nuns. So what? Ah! And then it's like my nose would just like open like the River Ganges. It was the worst thing ever for like 4 days.
Yeah, I heard David Walker actually talking about this on Courtney Fat Boy last week, I think, that he had a really bad sinus infection. And this thing, I had never actually had one until about a year and a half ago. It was actually not too long before I was on your show and Sarah had a sinus infection.
Right.
And we were going, neti pot, use the neti pot. And
then
we finally convinced her
to try
it. Better
to do it in the bathroom,
But because people told me to do it, and I was the same way. I was going, I don't know. I don't want to try it. But it got to the point where I couldn't, you know, it started with just some stuffiness, and then it got to the point where not only could I not breathe out of the left side of my face, but my face felt like hot and sore, and it just hurt behind my forehead, and it was so bad. And so I used the neti pot, and like nothing would come out the other side at first. That's what I think. And then I did that, and literally, this is exactly the same story David Walker told like last week and freaked out Carton Fat Boy. But I was sitting on the couch in my living room, and my husband watching me, and I'm like blowing my nose and just going, and just had that sensation you get, almost like I think you're giving birth. Like, if I just push this hard enough, this thing will come out of me. And I'm blowing my nose, and just blowing my nose a little more, and blowing my nose, and then suddenly there's this that I can feel resonate throughout my whole head. And then Patrick's looking over me, and I'm holding this Kleenex in my hand, and I swear, I go, oh my God, you have to look at this. And he's like, no. And I'm like, no, really, you have to look at this.
It's awesome.
I don't want to look at it. I'm going, yes, you do. You have never seen anything like this come out of a person's face before. And I swear, it was like the size of an oyster. And it was like gelatinous.
I'm so sorry to
and
everyone who's listening.
And it was horrifying. But it was fascinating because it was huge. It was huge. And that's what had been, had the bacteria had turned into inside my sinus.
See, because when you're pouring the neti pot stuff in, and then it doesn't come out the other side, then you're like, well, where is that going? And it's, you know, and I think some of it just gets absorbed by the lining of your sinuses or by whatever stalactites are up there.
Yeah.
And then it's like eventually your body's like, well, I think we're done with this now. It's just, out into the...
But ever since then, because that was so painful and so horrible, and that experience was so horrifying, that when I was looking at the neti pot and finding out that, your sinuses are huge.
Yeah. No.
The whole inside of your... About a third of the inside of your face is empty.
Yeah.
And it's just this warm, moist breeding ground for bacteria and crud.
Yes.
And so, the neti pot, the saline, the salt, creates sort of an inhospitable, environment for the bacteria. And it helps wash stuff out. And I swear to God, ever since I've been using that a couple of times a week for the last year and a half, I hardly have any colds. I haven't had any sinus problems ever since. It's been great.
Well, I had to be convinced to use that thing, too, because it's like I used it a couple years ago when I had a little bit of a blockage. Because I immediately lumped it in with, like, those freaks that want to jam a candle in your ear or something. And I'm just like... I'm like, stay away from me with your hippie nonsense.
Yeah, and a lot of it is couched, like, in this whole, like, ever since the time of the Buddha,
right,
yogi masters have been using the neti pot.
Well, that's the thing. It's always like a brown guy who lived 2,000 years ago used something, so therefore you ought to use it. But I am a big fan of that. Well, anyway, does it seem a little cooler in here?
It does.
It's almost
all of a sudden it seems cooler.
Well, they do listen downstairs, so bring me a ham sandwich. I'm just going to see how it works. All right. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. I don't have anything that interesting. I just have dog stories. But it's really just dog story. And I'll be real brief about it because I know how people are sometimes. But ironically, or a word like that, people would actually rather hear about goo coming out of your nose sometimes than I think about dogs. Just like, me hearing about, like, and then my child did the most precocious thing. We took Max to... I don't think I mentioned this, but we took Max to the vet the other day, or Lara took Max to the vet, because he had, long story short, like I had given him this, flea treatment, which I found out later on, by the way, my mother-in-law had given us, so I have her to blame for this. I put their flea treatment on, because I'm real good about that, but, and it's like, and I saw, well, this is a different brand, and I, but okay, and it was I won't name it, but it was I guess it was Hartz.
No, the Hartz stuff is...
Well,
I made my cat so sick giving her the Hartz flea stuff.
I know that now.
Yeah.
So, to my credit, I didn't buy it.
No, you didn't know.
I just saw
that stuff
it.
Is toxic crap.
Well, If only, would that you had been there. And I just said, well, here's your flea treatment, I guess, and I stuck it on him. And Philo was fine, but Max, it just made it. I mean, he didn't get sick, but his fur got all red, and he was, like, scratched. Like, what did you put on me? Agent Orange? You know, and he's just, and it turns out, yeah, my mother-in-law gave that to Lara the last time she was in Provo. So thanks for that. Anyway, so I had to take him, and then I gave him a bath. So I immediately, you know, Max is like running around the house, like I'm on fire, you know. And I take him in, and I feel terrible, you know. I've got that pet guilt of like I've caused harm to my child. And so I take him and I put him in the shower, and I'm standing in there in my, you know, my bare feet, and I'm giving Max a, you know, I'm giving him a bath or shampooing his fur or whatever to get it off of him because I feel terrible. Mm-hmm. And then he's like running around the house like a crazy dog because he's all wet and whatever. But then as I'm drying him off again later, I notice that there's this lump on his back. And not, like, from the flea stuff. Like, I wasn't irritated. It was like, it seemed like a growth of some kind. And I'm like, so it begins, you know. And here I thought he was impervious. And so I showed it to Lara. She's a nurse, and so, of course, she'll know about dog skin. And I said, what is up with this? You know, it's just, like, fine. Just, like, a thing that dogs get. She goes, oh, I don't know. We had to take him to the vet. And I am kind of like Patrick in that I don't go to the doctor my own self. It takes a lot to get me to go to the doctor. And I don't really take the dogs in. Except for their annual, you know, for their checkups, and if something is really wrong with them, like
yeah,
the time that
I'm
that,
the same way.
Yeah, the time he picked the fight with the Rottweiler, like he went to the vet. But the rest of the time, it's like you'll get past it. You're a dog, buck up. But Lara's like, I don't know, this is a skin thing. We got to take him in and whatever. It seems it could be a tumor, it could be some sort of, you know, like a malignant growth of some kind. And now then I'm stressing out. I'm like, oh God, you know what? Because then it's like you start to do all of the stuff that you don't want to do, but you do anyway, like going. What if they say it's $5,000 to cure whatever this undoubtedly lethal thing is? Will I pay $5,000, you know, for my dog's life? How could I not, you know? And then it's like, you know, the angel on my shoulder, like, you know, but you should let nature take its course. Isn't that what you're always saying? You know, and then, the, you know, and then, or whatever, you know, and then, the, you know, yes, but you could buy a car with that, you know, and it's only a dog. And then, what do you mean it's a dog? He's your friend, you know, and it's like the whole, but then you realize you would pay it. That's the thing. Like, the bottom line is if I had the money, you know, I would pay whatever the cost was if I was able to do so. So I've already come to that conclusion. Anyway, but she goes to the vet, you know, and then they're sitting there poking and prodding. And they do the little, it's not like a biopsy, but it's like where they take a little piece of it and they analyze it under a microscope or something. And then it turns out it's just that he's fat. He's actually so fat, his body has run out of places to store the fat inside. And his body has just started creating like a little annex of places. Like, let's build a separate little warehouse for this piece of fat. So it's just like a little fat bulge or something. It's like I forget what they even called it.
Yeah.
But they're like, well, it's basically just like
a fatty tumor. Yeah, is what they call them.
Yeah, yeah, they just say, well, it's basically like if you, like if you were building a new, like, you know, like a new pantry onto your house or something because you had too much food to store, you know. And so that's all they did. He had to go to the doctor, and they just told him that he's just so fat that his body has run out of places to put it. And I, to my credit, didn't think that he'd gotten fat. I hadn't thought he was a little stout. But so now we have to do the whole thing of putting him on a diet.
And I don't think dogs, by the way, I don't think dogs have to be overweight to get fatty tumor growths.
Right.
I mean, I think they can just happen without the dog actually being overweight.
Well, he then was able to do the hat trick though, because he has the fat and he has the tumor, and I swear to God,
he's a small little fluffy dog. I mean, I can see why it'd be hard to tell.
Yeah.
If he'd gotten fat.
Well, see, and that's my whole thing too. Is I immediately became the defensive parent, of like the kid with the lazy eye or the defective brain or the whatever. I become the parent who goes, I literally said this. I just said, well, no, he's not fat. He's just sort of husky, which is actually a double pun when you think about it. So, I mean, let's hear it for me.
Look at that.
But I started doing all the, he's just big boned, you know, of just all, I did everything but just say he had a slow metabolism. That's just society telling you he's fat, baby. I was like all defensive about the dog being told my dog was too fat. I was like, that's a lie. He's perfect. He's wonderful. He's beautiful. How dare you say that about our dog? As though the dog, you know, he's just sitting there just staring blankly at the carpet because he's got a brain like a pea. So, but then in the course of like a day, it switched. So at first I was all defensive about, you know, on Max's behalf. You know, like, I will not have you sully my dog. How dare you, madam? Shame on you. But now, every time she goes to feed the dog, I just have turned into Arnold Schwarzenegger the way he apparently was with his kids. I'm just going, well, you sure little Fattykins needs any food? Isn't that right? Fatty, fatty, fat, fat, you know? And I'm just, are you going to take Max for a walk with Philo? You know, Max is fat. And I don't know why I've started doing that, but it is another indication that I shouldn't have kids because I've just turned on him.
The thing is, it's so amusing to do that to your pets because, first of all, they're just oblivious.
Right.
That's part of why it's funny. It's like, I had a cat who was so fat. And he just, you know, we did the thing you always do with cats. You know, we just gave him, like, big, giant, endless bowls of kibble.
Right.
He can self-regulate. He's a cat.
No.
Well, this particular cat just ate and ate and ate and ate until he was weighed 22 pounds. And he would, like, come walking down the stairs, and you could just see his belly swaying from side to side.
Awesome.
He'd get to the bottom of the stairs, and then he'd just flop over on his side on the carpet. Because he was so tired from coming down the stairs.
Spoon it into my mouth, please.
And he'd just lay down. If he jumped onto the floor off the couch, he would go, oof.
That's awesome.
And so he would walk into the room, and I would just see him, and I'd go, shrimp boats are coming, and then start laughing. And then the cat would just, like, stare at me like,
what is up?
Why I hate you. Because they don't know why you're laughing, but cats hate it when you laugh at them.
They can sense the vibe, the energy.
Yeah, so then we had to put him on a diet. We had to give him diet cat food, which it's like, so then what happens then is he's still just eating and eating and eating as much as he wants, but he's still always hungry all the time. So he would just come into the room and stare at me and just go, meow!
Awesome.
Meow! And just yell at me. And I'm like, I know, dude. I've been on low-fat diets, and it sucks. You're grumpy and angry and always hungry.
And so we got to do that thing now where we're like, step onto the scale with Max and then step off the scale without him so we can figure out how much he weighs. Because we don't have like a little pet weight, and he doesn't want to stand on the thing or whatever. So, good times.
So are you buying special, you going to buy special food or just cut back
on his rations?
We're just
giving him less. And then also I have to keep a closer eye on him because he'll do the thing of like going and body checking Philo out of the way and stealing whatever Philo has.
Yeah.
Which I try to catch most of the time, but I know that there's certain times I won't because I'll be out of the room and I'll just hear a and Philo will run and hide in the kitchen or you know or like in the closet in the bedroom, and I know that the Max has just gone in and whatever that is, it's mine, poof, you know, and just kicked him out of the way. So, which is funny because you know again, Philo's just huge. All right, we're ending the dog talk. It's 503-505-6964. Still to come, we got your greatest songs ever made. We got your Anna Griffin from the Oregonian, your Mike Russell, and your so forth. Right now, it's Don Taylor at the news desk.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Police say a new father faces drug charges because he lit up a marijuana joint instead of a cigar to celebrate his child's birth at a Western Pennsylvania hospital. Police aren't identifying the man found smoking the pot in a designated smoking area of Uniontown Hospital Tuesday morning, but say he'll face marijuana possession charges. Uniontown Police Sergeant Jonathan Grebiak tells the Pittsburgh Tribune Review that a nurse smelled the marijuana when she took a cigarette break in the same area, and a hospital security guard told police about 3:20 a.m. Grebiak said the man told him, "I'm having a baby and wanted to get a buzz," and then pulled a bag of marijuana from his shoe.
And he was in the hospital when he did this?
Yeah.
Sort of a, who's with me?
He's probably outside the hospital. He's at a designated smoking area. So
well, I guess you can't do
right
it in
outside
the
hospital.
At least he was doing it, you know, somewhere other than the waiting room because you can't do it there now. So this is sort of like the Ricky Ricardo pacing around and then giving everybody a cigar sort of thing. But he's,
but
you know.
With,
and he
with
was
marijuana.
Where? Did you say Pennsylvania?
Yeah, Pennsylvania.
Well, you know, maybe it's, I don't know. Maybe it's a thing. Maybe it has supplanted the cigar, the celebratory, you know, like maybe the women buy tiny cupcakes. Guys, they pull out some reefer. Who's to say?
Do women buy tiny cupcakes when they have babies?
Don't women buy tiny cupcakes to celebrate everything? Doesn't that, like, every occasion now call for a box of tiny cupcakes that costs $100?
Are tiny cupcakes different from regular cupcakes? I mean, are you saying extra small cupcakes?
Yeah, like, you know, like a regulation cupcake you'd have when you were a kid was like this, but like a Saint cupcake is like, I think basically it's like a thimble cake, basically.
Well, I've had, like, this normal size Saint cupcakes. They make regular size cupcakes.
But a normal size, see, now we're getting into, like, a linguistic
thicket. I think they also make mini cupcakes.
A normal size Saint cupcake, though. Is that smaller still, though, than a regulation size, like, run-of-the-mill cupcake?
You might be thinking that cupcakes when you were a child were larger because your hands were smaller.
I believe
cupcake size has stayed somewhat regulation
It seems like the cupcakes that I've always seen from Saint Cupcake, but they do sell a miniature cupcake. So
yeah,
maybe
there,
that's
there
what
are
I've
mini,
got.
Mini cupcakes.
Well, that's probably what I've seen then. Because they were like Lilliputian cakes. I mean, they were minuscule. You had to get a jeweler's glass to figure out what the flavor was. So here's Don Taylor.
Let's do our penis watch.
Here is your penis watch for Thursday right in the Rick Emerson radio program.
Take a look at my enormous penis and my troubles start a melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis and everything is going my way.
Here is Don Taylor with your watch. Tenere? No. I was trying to do a Castalia penis. Oh. Watch is Mira? Mira de...
I know Mira is... Yeah,
it's
Mira
like
is
look,
look
or watch. Yeah, yeah. Something de penis. Sorry, here's Don Taylor.
Malaysia's first gay-themed film, which will open in cinemas in February, is set to raise eyebrows in this conservative, mainly Muslim Southeast Asian country where homosexuality remains a taboo subject. Called in the Malay language Penis in a Bottle, it tells the story of a relationship between Ruby, a transsexual Muslim man, and her wayward male lover, Gauss. The movie offers no racy love scenes to survive scrutiny by the country's strict film censors, but will set a precedent in a nation where sex between males is a legal offense under the country's criminal laws.
Her lover's name is Gauss?
Gauss.
Okay, I'm working just for you nerds. I'm working on a magnetism joke right now.
It's G-H-A-U-S. I don't know how you in Malaysia. I don't know. This is the first movie in Malaysia about gays, and it's going to get attention because it's something different, said Wan Raja, who plays Gauss, after a preview screening of the movie in the capital city. Malaysia only allows films to feature homosexuality if the characters repent or are killed off, and those characters are usually minor.
This, by the way, just like anybody, you know, I know that we've got problems, as Alice Cooper would say. We got problems in the east, south, north, and west. We got all kinds of problems right here in River City. But, I mean, you could say this for our country as contrasted with some others, in this case Malaysia. I think we long ago passed the point of having our first film about homosexuality in which it wasn't a requirement that they, like, be beheaded at the end.
Yeah, well,
Jesus.
We still don't see much in the way of almost nothing in the way of mainstream Hollywood films, though, that feature gay characters as primary characters, much less in romantic.
Can I tell you this? That Lara's father-in-law, who's a very straight-laced Mormon, actually sent her the weirdest email the other day because he's very, you know, he grew up in the South. He's as he would refer to himself, he's a country boy, and very conservative. Not a bad guy, but I would say not exposed to a lot of the world. He emails her the other day and he's like, "So I hear a lot about this movie, Midnight Cowboy. Is that a movie I should watch? You think?" And Lara,
a Western.
Yeah, Lara shouted him. She's like, "Should my dad watch Midnight Cowboy?" And I'm like, "Yes, absolutely, he should. It's a fantastic movie. It won an Academy Award, you know." And we never heard back. So I have to follow up and see exactly how that went down.
Follow it up with that Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah.
That's about sheep farmers.
And then just
very
that,
manly.
Then there's that one called Hump It Out, Volume 9.
Rump Rangers 12. It's excellent. Producer Raja Azmi Raja Suleiman said the movie was based on the life of a friend and that her intention was to offer a glimpse into the life of a transsexual. She submitted her script not only to the country's National Censorship Board for approval, but also to Malaysia's official Islamic Authority for advice. "I told them the title of the film was Penis in a Bottle," she said, "and that it was a gay movie about a transsexual, and they said, 'Why are you doing this?'" The Islamic Authority ultimately approved the script as it included Ruby's eventual regret over her sex change operation.
Okay.
But the title, which refers to how Ruby keeps her removed male genitalia in a bottle, was rejected and it will be released in Malaysia as .. a bottle.
Okay. There you go.
So,
all right.
There you go.
That's our quirky neighbor to the east. There you go. Your penis watch for Thursday right on the Rick
Take
Emerson Radio program.
My enormous penis. My troubles start melting away.
I tried, and by the way, successfully, not to do like a bad Sting Police, you know.
Penis in a bottle.
It was like cycling through my head the entire time, and I didn't do it. Let's do one more here. We'll do Your Greatest Songs Ever coming up, and then we'll talk to Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. Later on, Mike Russell from Culture Pulp, who's going to talk about his recent series of interviews with Berkeley Breathitt of Bloom County fame. Here is Dawn Taylor.
There's still no explanation for the mysterious vapor or smoke trail seen two evenings ago off the west coast of the U.S. that many people speculate was a missile. Weapons analyst John Pike thinks the real concern should be that the government can't figure out what it was. He thinks it was just an airplane contrail.
Why the government is so badly organized that...
What?
I'm sorry. I'm sure he has things to say that are important, but I have to just get that out of my system first. Okay. Wow. All right.
I wasn't expecting that.
Okay. It's a slow day in Pahrump. Okay. start this again.
Okay.
I don't know what this guy looks like. I don't know who he is. I don't know where this audio comes from, you know, like what the original source, or like where he was when he said this.
I strongly
suspect he's speaking into a webcam as he does his internet-based conspiracy show, which has listeners in the dozens.
As soon as he started speaking, I immediately got this vision in my head of Jack D. Ripper from Dr. Strangelove.
Totally. He's just... Okay. It's one of those guys doing a show with Chuck Harder. Okay, here we go. What's this guy's name?
John Pike.
why the government is so badly organized that they're not able to get somebody out there to explain it and make this story go away. I think that's the real story. I mean, it's absolutely insane that they can't get somebody out there to explain what's incredibly obvious.
All right, and Skyping into the Jeff Rentz program.
He says, surely there's someone in the government who can see the contrails were left by an airplane.
All of the money we're spending for all of these technically competent people, that they can't get somebody out there to explain what's incredibly obvious.
Although I guess by definition, he wouldn't be one of those guys that we're talking about, because he's just saying it's an airplane. Like, he's effectively saying, well, it's just a weather balloon. So by definition, he would probably not have a program anywhere that people were listening to, because that didn't really seem to get you a lot of you have to say that it was, you know, I don't know, that it was something that they were like using to secretly put plutonium into your bones. Mm. What's going on over there?
All of a sudden, I smell tuna.
Stroke. You know what happens if you try to blow your nose too hard, even when your nose resists? That's a thing where it just, you give yourself a stroke. It breaks blood vessels in your head. I'm not making that up, by the way. That's true. All right. Anyway. It's probably just a contrail that's being put over the building by
Maybe.
The man, Don. All right.
A flying tuna.
All right. Did we say we were breaking after that?
We did say that.
Let's
you said that.
Hear the beginning of his quote one more time, because it makes me laugh.
Okay.
Why the government is so badly organized that they're not able to get somebody out
there. He does sound like, he also sounds a little bit like the guy from The Great Race. The push the button, Max. Awesome.
I love people who say "can't."
Yeah. Well, you know, when he ought to say "nix." all right. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us. We've got boy, that was just like, even for us, that was like a series. It was a fun house of obscure references we just did there.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. Still to come, Anna Griffin from the Oregonian, Mr. Mike Russell of CulturePulp.com. We may or may not get to a top five later on. We got your Taser Watch coming up. We got your Corpse Watch coming up. And in just a moment, we have another installment of the greatest songs ever made.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
All right, then. Did I already do the... I was doing the thing of trying to figure out how to say the penis watch in Spanish, right?
You did.
And I went through Tener. Oh, we came up with it. It was Mira, probably.
Yeah.
All right. Well, see, and that's one of those things where it's like, you just having heard... I mean, I really, all the Spanish I know at this point is basically just through osmosis. It's like I knew people who kind of spoke Spanish or who did speak Spanish. Or, you know, I had a friend of mine who was a Spanish teacher. And just, like, proximity with her, I learned how to speak some of it. And it's because largely the Spanish is a language that just follows all of its own rules, which is the thing. Is like, she was the one who actually said, like, I'm going to teach you how to pronounce Spanish out loud in, like, 5 minutes. And she's like, you're not going to know what you're saying necessarily, but, like, you'll be able to say it. Correctly. The upshot of this, by the way, is that you don't meet a lot of Spanish speakers who do whatever the Spanish equivalent of saying Washington is, because I think that that's just, first of all, I would imagine that that's just viewed as unacceptable, you know, in that language as it is in all right-thinking variations on this tongue. But also, Spanish is just a language that you look at the word, you can figure out how it's pronounced, because the letters operate in typically one way and one way only. The word placement operates in one way and one way only most of the time. And so you're going to find it's a thing you can pick up pretty easily. And once you can actually say it out loud, then the next step is using it in conversation. Once you use it in conversation, then you're actually able to use it in conversation without even really thinking about it, without even consciously processing it. You're able to just speak the words into a sentence form, and you're going to be able to actually hold, just entire discussions in it. And it's going to happen a lot faster than you expect. Now, if it didn't happen this way when you learned it in high school, it's probably because they were just having you memorize things and then recite them back mindlessly, which is, not the way to get your learn on, as the kids say.
Ver penne.
Ver. Is that like a werewolf kind of a thing? Ver, it's please to spell.
V-E-R, which basically means view.
Oh, so like, could it also focus as function as like an imperative statement, like a look at my penis?
Something
ver penne!
Like, well, if you wanted it to be like, say, as a an adverbial phrase, a ver, let me see, a ver, El penne.
This is exactly the kind of phrase that Clara Garbo was hoping we would use for exemplification when talking about her business. You can find out more about Castalia Language Center at portlandspanish.com. That is portlandspanish.com. And most importantly, especially to those of you that might be ever so slightly antisocial, they keep the class sizes small. So it's going to be you and seven other people, you and seven other folks. So maximum class size of 8 people. You're going to get near individual attention. And because it's a school for adults, you're not just going to have to sit there with a bunch of people who aren't really interested in learning, that are basically there there just because they need the credits to graduate. You're going to be there with people who are trying to learn Spanish and who want to learn it at the same rate, the same way, the same speed as everybody else, and it's going to work out well for you. So that is Castalia Language Center. You can find out more about them at PortlandSpanish.com. PortlandSpanish.com, Castalia Language Center.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
I'm Rick Emerson, and these are the greatest songs ever made. Rarely has a song been so widely listened to, yet so little heard. Misinterpretations of rock and pop songs are, of course, nothing new. Timmy, who was caught in the mineshaft, met a more gruesome fate than his song's bouncy melody would imply. Every Breath You Take is not a song that should be played at your wedding, unless you're marrying Elizabeth Smart. And today's song is not celebratory, though it does pay its own kind of stark, beautiful tribute. Written in 1981 as the title song for a never-made Paul Schrader film, the first demo version ever recorded was made on January 3, 1982, in Colts Neck, New Jersey. The song was, after a time, slated to appear on its creator's 1982 acoustic album, though that plan, too, was scrapped as producers felt the song's lyrics and melody didn't quite fit with the other compositions. The song eventually went on to multi-platinum status, albeit in a radically reworked fashion. And while the drastic overhaul of the song's melody and production served it well, it is, even now, a stirring and glorious piece of rock, one of the great American songs of all time. It also masked the song's real meaning. Rather than an anthem of traditional, easily bumper-stickerable pride, the song is about pride unrewarded, duty unrepaid, loyalty betrayed. It is the story of a man who stumbles early in his life and who finds himself in dire straits because of it. And when he thinks he's come out the other side, he finds himself alone, feeling abandoned by the country he served. He's a man with nowhere to run and nowhere to go. One of the greatest songs ever made, this is Bruce Springsteen, and Born in the USA, on The Rick Emerson Show on the Emerson News Network.
Thank you.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. And in response to a couple of messages in the text box just now, yes, so the album I was referring to is Nebraska. That is what that was originally written for. Remind me, I got to make a note to myself to give a copy of that to Ryan White at some point because he was asking me about that. So that was the original acoustic version of Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us on this Thursday. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Be sure to join us tomorrow when our guest will include Mr. Big Jim Willig, friend to children everywhere.
Is that true?
In a non-checkable, non-verifiable kind of way.
If I was a child, I'm not sure if I would either be delighted by Big Jim or kind of scared of him.
Well, probably both at once, sort of like I was by Bob Keenan or Keeshan or whatever his name was. Who was the Captain Kangaroo Keeshan guy? Where he's sort of, like he had the sort of, He had the mannerisms of a guy who really was nice and cared about you and, you know, just seemed sort of jovial and jocular. But then he had these weird, twinkling, crazy eyes that occasionally seemed like they were going to leap out of his head. He had this sort of weird, manic energy that seemed barely restrained at certain moments in the program.
Okay, maybe you can answer this. This is a question no one has ever been able to explain to
me. He is not a captain, nor is he a kangaroo.
No, but maybe—
You were lied to.
No one has ever been able to definitively answer this. Okay. There was Bunny Rabbit, right? And there was, like, that moose guy. They were puppets.
Mr. Moose.
And Bunny Rabbit would occasionally make ping pong balls rain from the sky.
Right.
Why did he do that? Why did he make ping pong balls fall? I remember the ping pong balls. I remember the rabbit. But I don't remember why the ping pong balls fell.
What a joyless binary childhood you must have had. Why do ping pong balls need a reason to fall from the sky? Why can't it just be a bit of surrealistic fun?
Well, he had to have some motivation
for doing it. Let me ask you this. Are you asking why in terms of the show's construction or its amusement value to children did there need to be ping pong balls? Or are you asking what is the in-show mechanism or trigger by which the balls fell in manner of green slime on You Can't Do That on Television being triggered by the phrase, I don't know?
Something like, yes, more that one.
Are you saying, like, what did the rabbit do to make the balls fall from the sky? Was there a magic word?
No.
Or what was his reasoning or motivation?
Yes, what was his motivation? Why?
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
That was a big overture and a little show just there. I know. I'm sorry, but I don't know. Yeah, the answer is...
No one knows.
Well, maybe Mike Russell knows. We'll find out later. Another woman who may, in fact, have access to that information, although the odds makers don't believe so, is Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. She writes a twice-weekly column about life in Portland and in Multnomah County. Hello, how are you?
I like that music.
This is... I selected this for you, actually, weeks ago, and I used it the first week you were on, and then it became one of those things that I just, that's really great, I got to make sure to, and then I forgot about it the instant, like it fell through the drain in the base of my brain as soon as the show was over.
I walk in the room and there's a conversation about, what is the metaphor expressed by the falling ping pong balls?
And here's the thing, I got to tell you that maybe because I found him ever so slightly unnerving, I didn't really watch a lot of Captain Kangaroo when I was a kid. I mean, I watched some, like enough to be familiar with it, but it's not like a thing I watched all the time.
I found Mr. Green Jeans far more disconcerting than the captain.
Yes. I did not like him.
Change your clothes.
Yeah.
Well, the lasting legacy of Captain Kangaroo is that the show seems to have had a really profound effect on Paul Rubens, because when I saw Pee-wee's Playhouse, the first thing I thought with it, more than any other children's program that I had seen in the past, it bore a striking similarity in a really, really hyperkinetic kind of way to Captain Kangaroo.
It feels like a certain cosmic justice that he's on Broadway now, doesn't it?
Yes.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, is it with the Pee-wee Herman show?
Yeah, yeah. He's having this huge resurgence. I think what it is, I was thinking about this, I think what it is he had to, like, wait basically until the people who grew up as kids watching Pee-wee's Playhouse were old enough that they could embrace him, like, on Broadway, because they were so young when he had his, like, porn scandal. That had to blow over for those of us of an age to remember that. But people who were, like, 10 when Pee-wee's Playhouse was on, they are now ticket-buying adults for, like, Broadway shows and stuff, and now they're ready to embrace his return.
Well, and probably because that would have been, what, like 1992, 93, something like that when that happened? So it's strange even now when you look back that was such a big deal. And I think a lot of it has to do with, with the mugshot and the fact that the image presented to us on the evening news of the guy who we knew as Pee-wee Herman just did not jive at all with, you know, with reality. And, like, how could it? Because, I mean, it's like, imagine how disconcerting. What would they have preferred? That, like, Pee-wee Herman with, like, his tiny, too small suit and his red bow, you know, it's like,
as really he, like that.
Turn and face the camera, Mr. Rubens. You know, and he's just sort of, you know, But I think it was just such a weird, jarring, like shattering of the illusion, even though we all kind of knew it was, you know, not reality. I think it was so weird to people that we kind of put it away in a drawer, and a lot of we didn't want to think about it. But also, it just seems, you know what it seems like now? It seems like one of those things where like Chuck Berry being busted for the violation of the Mann Act in 1955, that it's such an outdated blue law kind of a crime in some ways. That they probably look back and they go, he was arrested for what? Well, that's insane.
Well, also the fact that his Pee-wee's Playhouse, while being on Saturday morning and really appealing to a child demographic, also was very adult. And there was a lot of sly wink-wink, you know, sort of gay humor. And I mean, the first season, one of his best friends was I can't remember. He was like some soccer playing guy who just ran around with no shirt on and these tiny little shorts carrying a soccer ball. His Pee-wee's Christmas special he did, he had like the gay men's choir as the Marine Corps band.
Really?
Singing on his Christmas show. And his guests were like Charo and stuff.
That's
so,
like concentric circles of awesome.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Was the soccer guy, this late date, it just becomes such a fuzzy blur of things that I can no longer tell one thing apart from another sometimes. Did the soccer guy kind of look like Alfonso Ribeiro?
In my mind, I keep thinking he looks kind of like Mario Lopez.
That's exactly what he looked like.
So maybe I'm kind of remembering him, but not quite.
And he'd just walk in and Pee Wee would say, hey, Pablo, what are you doing? I'm going to go play soccer, Pee Wee. Do you want to come? No, I got to visit my friend. Okay. And then he'd just walk off and leave.
I am a random element of entropy on your show for no reason. And now I leave.
Yeah.
All right. I don't even know what the hell we were talking about.
We have Anna Griffin here to talk about serious City of Portland matters.
You really are a chaos element. That's the strange thing about it, actually, is believe it or not, this show is far more structured than I think it has any right to be, and more structured than it was, let's say, 10 years ago. But there's this weird paradox that happens where when you enter it's like how photons that are separated by many, many miles. If one has its rotational spin altered, then miles away, the other one simultaneously reverses itself for no reason. You come into the studio and you are very calm and structured and linear in terms of thought, and then cognitive processes just go to hell
and you just go off the rails.
Yeah, I just got nothing. Hey, here's a question: you have a child or children?
Children.
Are they aware of Pee-wee's Playhouse? Is that a thing you have them watch?
Never seen it.
Really?
I would let them watch it.
Is it that they have not requested it, or is it because it's available, right?
You can rent it
or something.
DVD.
Do you have a whole list of things that you are going to have them watch at various ages, though, so they can be?
That's on the list. Absolutely. Yeah, there are certain things that that they watch that they've picked up by osmosis. You know, Disney stuff, princess things,
right.
and Bakugan for the boy, and then there are certain things that are the sort of cultural touchstones. Like when I had a child. My partner and I had a debate about when Star Wars was appropriate.
And like, you're going to start with Episode 4. You're going to make them. Are they going to watch them chronologically by release or chronologically by time frame?
We do not acknowledge the existence of the
Good
more recent
you.
Films.
Well done. No, I'm very proud of you.
When my son is out of the house and a consenting adult, he can choose to watch those, but not under my roof.
Do you have the original versions or the special editions?
Oh, the original versions.
Okay. See, that's what I'm talking about right there. See, you ought to have 50 kids.
No, I should not.
No, seriously, because it's just, you know, to kind
of threaten her.
I'm just saying, there's some gum chewer at Walmart right now who's busy buying a box set of According to Jim because my boy's going to see this as soon as he's able. You know, where they're basically, he's going to do that thing of just like holding the speakers to his wife's stomach like people do with Mozart or something.
Does Jim Belushi love him?
I don't think anybody's doing that with According to Jim.
Son, let me tell you about Meet Wally Sparks.
I've been waiting all my life to show you Three's Company. It's the greatest American comfort is.
Hey, speaking of people at stores just kind of standing around slack-jawed like mules, what were people camping out for? You were telling me this before we went on the air just now.
200 people camped out downtown this morning for the noon opening of H&M.
I don't even know what H&M is. Don Taylor?
It's a clothing store that apparently the clothes aren't bad and they're really super cheap. That's all I know. I'm lacking that lady gene, so I don't really keep up on the clothing things.
I mean, is it an upscale clothing store?
I don't know.
No, it's just, I think this stuff is actually, it's kind of like the Target of clothes or something.
It's like a fashionable Old Navy.
Yeah, it's like things are apparently like fairly fashionable, but they're really, really cheap.
The best part, by the way, is how you said it's like a fashionable Old Navy. And meanwhile, I am like, I think two-thirds of the things that I am currently wearing come from Old Navy. So thanks for that. I appreciate that. Rick Emerson appreciates your support. I always wonder when people are camping out for something like that, like to what – I always want to ask them, like, how did you hear about it, or how did you get the idea that this specific facet of your patronage, like the camping out, like where did that come from?
In hindsight, I feel like a horrible person because I was just trying to walk past it as quickly as possible without making eye contact with anyone.
But did you figure they were just squatters?
No, they were clearly not. They were much better dressed than most Portland squatters.
I don't think you should feel bad for that at all. Honestly, that's kind of how I deal with almost all crowd situations, actually. Just get through it. Don't look at them. Don't make eye contact.
I felt really old because they all seemed to be under the age of about 25.
Yeah.
And it made me feel like, why don't you people get a job?
Oh, man. You know, it's like every time, let me just tell you, nothing will make you feel old like going to buy clothes. And I mean, I think it's maybe a thing that women get hit with harder because there's, you know, so much image consciousness that is just foisted onto women from the moment they're born. But it's like, you know, I'm just, my whole thing is I basically just want like Garanimals for adults where it's like anything is interchangeable with anything. I want all my clothes to work like a habit trail where any part will hook onto any other part and I can walk out of the house without being mocked. And so as a result, everything I own just comes from either Old Navy or The Gap because it all kind of works together in a kind of vague white guy lameness sort of a way. But it's like I walk in there and I immediately feel like I have just switched into dog years or something because everyone, first of all, everybody who works there seems like they're about 12. And then there was that thing. It's like I bought some socks or like some of my patented zany boxer shorts or something there like a month ago. And it's like the chick behind the counter calls me sir, which is, you know, which is not a thing that happens all that often. But when it does, it's just like a tiny knife of despair, like right into one of my ventricles. It's all very unpleasant. I have this thing about people camping out, and I wonder if maybe that is just part of the human cultural imperative. And now that we no longer camp out for like record releases or whatever, concert tickets. Like, yeah. Man, people don't really do that anymore, do they?
No, now we camp out for our iPad.
Yeah, I mean, that but that's the thing.
Consumer goods.
But that has supplanted, you know, the other because it's. I think there must be some, like, weird communal desire to do that. Or they just hire people to come do it. I mean, they just, you know, if I were a store, I would actually just pay, you know, some people who are unemployed just to hang out like it was the greatest thing ever.
I think it's the Krispy Kreme people. They have this genius thing they do that when they open a new store, they have this thing that the first like 100 people are going to get a card for like free donuts for a year.
It's Chick-fil-A.
Chick-fil-A, that's right.
And it's free
chicken
for a year.
That is so great and sad that you know that.
If a Chick-fil-A opened here, I would camp out.
And the thing is, though, that what that does is it gets hundreds of people camped out in front of the store. And, of course, the news media comes down and they cover all the idiots sitting in line waiting for their Chick-fil-A.
Bob, residents are camped out often for days on end for something called a Chick-fil-A.
Yeah, it's a genius marketing plan.
This area, man. So that explains a lot if that's why they do it. But let me ask you this about the Chick-fil-A. I was under the impression that there was one not like right in Portland proper, but somewhere on the outskirts.
I don't think there are any in Oregon.
There was one here.
There was one at one of the malls, like Clackamas Town Center or Washington Square.
See, and I said that too, but then somebody told me. Because
Lloyd Center.
Was it Lloyd Center? Mike Russell says from the cheap seats. Really? Oh. How long ago was that?
About 5 years ago, there was one there, I think.
Oh, God, I've become that guy. I've become that. Well, isn't the old Jenkins barn still there? That's where you take a right. And then it's just a hop and a skip down the road. You can't. It's like the Jenkins barn burned down like 40 years ago. All right. Because they did some event together, you know, like a couple months ago where it's like if you went, I swear to God, like if you went dressed as a chicken or something, they would give you like five Chick-fil-A. And the Chick-fil-A sandwiches are, they're quite good. I mean, that's a thing of sublime culinary joys.
I almost never actually bought food at Chick-fil-A, but I would always take the free sample. Never turn down the free Chick-fil-A sample because it's like, that was good.
Let me say this about Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A, it really is enshrined in like the hall of food-based heroes in my mind right next to a place called Del Taco. And see, and you lived in Southern California. You know,
yes.
You know what I'm talking about with Del Taco.
I know Del Taco.
Del Taco, the home of Macho Nachos, which are really just, I mean, it's like, it's like dozens of pounds of not really, strictly speaking, good or quality food, but goddamn, I could just eat food from that place just at a gallop for what seemed like hours when I was living in Utah. I lived at this sort of house of dudes, and there was a Del Taco down the street, and it was like once a night, like one of the dudes would be dispatched to Del Taco because they had this thing where you could get 10 tacos for $10, which was just it just seemed like the most glorious value for your money. And so you would come over, and it was just like a bad – it was like something just pulled from, like, Judd Apatow's, like, trash bin you know, like after an all-night bender or something, where there would be like a guy sorting his weed on like a Yes album cover, and somebody else with like a 4-foot-high graphics bong with a clown on the front of it watching a snowboarding video, and then the rest of the room was silent, but for the trough-like noises of as we just consumed Del Tacos by like the hectare. It was awesome. It was really, and I say that and it sounds horrible, but some of you folks out there, you know what I'm talking about. It was really a many splendored time.
So this H&M store, is that where the Schumacher Furs used to be?
No, Schumacher's was further west.
What did it replace? It actually replaced something fairly significant.
It was not Saks.
I can't remember.
Because Saks was right in Pioneer Place, and this is...
Is the Saks gone, too?
We know nothing.
I never know where... See, I just know where anything is. All I know about the Schumacher Furs, if you drive by that place, it's still got the weird fake blood outside. like, they've never bothered to scrub. Like, I guess the guy who owned the building was like, F it, I'm moving.
So that's it. I quit.
Yeah, and it's like whoever is responsible for that building right now, even if it's, like, defaulted to the city or something, is not actually taking the time to clean it. So it's like... I went by there the other day, actually. I don't know, maybe a couple weeks ago, and there was actually some guy, some girl out there in like the weird little like defend animals costumes, and they were just sort of like sitting there wandering. It was like nobody had told them, or they'd gotten like an out, like they hadn't checked the date on the email or something.
They just have nowhere else in town to go.
No,
so they just keep going there.
I was
gonna
tell
them, like the zombies in going back to the mall.
That's totally it. It's like they just didn't. They're like, I don't know where everybody is. Maybe they'll show up or something. So I. Fortunately, they were right down the street from the Scientology Center, so I like to think that day wasn't like a total waste. They could just make it, you know, just do like an outdated protest, you know, circuit of the entire city. Anna Griffin for the Oregonian. So in addition to folks hanging out for the opening of a store, what else is going on in our fair metropolis?
We have survived the elections. We have survived the horrors of Halloween. We are on. I mean, I was telling Mike before we came on, we should just fast forward to 2011 because the year's pretty much over now.
So there's really nothing to look forward to. There are going to be no exciting events of any kind. This is, we peaked pretty much.
We are in rerun season. Yeah.
When did they call it relative to when the polls closed? When did they call the Kitzhaber thing?
It was a good 20. Well, if polls closed at 8 p.m., it was not quite 24 hours later.
And is that's an uncommon thing for this, for this part of the world, right? The eastern part of the United States, they're used to having really exceptionally close or contested elections, but that didn't happen a lot here.
No, because it's such a Democratic state that you usually, if it's a Democrat versus a Republican, it's not a hard call. Part of what happened in the Kitzhaber race was similar to what happened in the Jeff Merkley-Gordon Smith race a couple years ago, and that Merkley on election night stood up and said, we just don't know, and then he woke up the next day and he was United States Senator. Multnomah County had a lot of votes come in at the last minute, and it took a long time to count those, and so...
Do you suppose that, I mean, do they just, is it a thing where they literally just stay awake all night, or do they, I mean, is there some semblance of... Is there some semblance of normalcy that that goes on in government, or even
can't start counting until 9 a.m. Sorry, can't. No, they count most of the night.
Do we ever figure out whether they actually count any of the ballots that are complete and returned early in advance, or whether they wait until 8:01 or whatever when the polls are closed to start running them through the machine?
I did not get an answer to that question.
Because that's a thing that I would really want to know. Because it seems like you could operate much more efficiently, if you were going to be counting them in advance.
Well, you can actually go online now and see if your vote was counted.
Really?
A state website, that you can go on and just type in your name and your address, and it'll tell you if your vote was counted.
That surprises me, actually. Here's the thing. Here's the great thing about that is that seems like a harbinger of the inevitable online voting. That seems like a little bit of what that is. That's a sort of a technological test balloon to see if people will accept. Because if there's ever going to be, if the city is ever going to accept voting over the net, I mean, it's going to be a city like Portland. It's not like Ogden, Utah, or somebody's really going to embrace that. But that seems very much like somebody is laying the infrastructure for a type of, for a future online voting system.
I like that. Then Bristol Palin could be elected governor.
Doesn't Bristol Palin sound like a company that makes toothbrushes or something?
Yeah, aspirin.
Yeah.
Did you catch or cover his Kitzhaber's speech about, because apparently we're going to be up to our eyeballs in jobs now that he's going to be governor.
John's going to make everything better.
Yeah.
Daddy's back.
We're
all going to be fine.
He's got this jobs plan. So he's got the.
Doesn't he look like he's going to make everything better?
He really does. He has this. There's a sort of paternal comfort that I feel when I look at him.
He's going to put on his plaid flannel shirt and his jeans and stand in the woods and make everything better.
Kitzhaber makes me feel. I know this sounds really strange. But Kitzhaber makes me feel the way I feel when I look at Tom Skerritt, where he just. I swear to God, it's like Tom Skerritt just seems like a guy who could take care of business. Yeah. You know, no matter what it is, it doesn't matter. He can make you pancakes. He can kill your enemies. It doesn't. He can. That's Tom Skerritt, not Kitzhaber.
Oh, I think Kitzhaber could take care of your enemies.
But he's, and make pancakes.
But he seems like a guy who has his hand firmly on the wheel, and that is really what American voters respond to.
It is a very squishy, intangible thing, that kind of charisma. And it's funny because it does feel almost overnight like, oh, things are going to be fine now.
Right.
Kitz is back. And Kulongoski, he does not have that.
No.
He has many skills, but he does not have that kind of natural.
No, honestly, I could have like smacked straight into him like on a street corner and not realized he was the governor. Well, I don't even know what he looks like. And he was governor. How long was Kulongoski in charge?
He still is actually in charge.
Well, yes, he is. But I honestly would not recognize him if I was in the room with him. I don't know what he looks like.
That's what makes it so astounding to me that Jerry Brown, that lets you know, by the way, how out of whack things are in California. Because Jerry Brown, I mean, however shrewd he may be as a politician, and the answer is obviously exceptionally shrewd. And he's, you know, and he's a very forward-thinking guy, especially when he was, you know, back in 75 when he had the first round of governorship there. He was very forward-thinking for that time and for that part of the country. Even post-Watergate, he was exceptionally liberal. But he doesn't have a lot of gravitas. It's not like you look at Jerry Brown and like think that that is a man who's going to, you know, he's going to clean up the mess, and he's going to, you know, he's going to point us in a, you know, point us to a bright new horizon. So that indicates exactly how far gone people feel like the economy in California, for example, is.
Well, and it's a very rare thing, that ability to walk in a room and kind of change the temperature.
Right.
And we take for granted, you know, you see somebody like Chris Dudley. I mean, Chris Dudley, very smart guy, clearly. Very personable guy, clearly. People like him. People trust him with their money.
He's very tall.
He's very tall, which, as a tall person, I applaud that. But he just, people take for granted how hard politics can be and how the ability to get in front of a microphone or get in front of TV cameras and take complicated ideas and boil them down into bite-sized servings and do that with conviction every time out, it is a form of intelligence. And it's very rare, and it's very hard. And it's funny. I mean, I've heard some people just in the last couple of days say, oh, everything's better. Kitz is back. And it's like, he's just got that. Yeah, you say gravitas. I mean, it's almost a sort of mojo that you have. Not to get to Austin Powers, but it is.
It's what Stan Freberg used to call the gazinkus. And he talked about it in terms of, he was referencing Billy Graham, who he said was the same thing. You walk into the room, and he said that he was at a party one time, and Billy Graham walked in, and it was that whole thing where it's like he didn't even really know who had come in the room, but it was just like this sense that the as you said, the temperature had changed, that the sort of makeup had changed.
You can sort of smell the static electricity.
And that is there are any number of people, Ralph Nader comes to mind, he's exceptionally intelligent. I mean, just like scarily, freakishly intelligent, but just lacks, he lacks that sort of whether it's charisma or whether it's, any sort of personal magnetism. He lacks something that inspires a sort of spark in people. He doesn't really excite people except in the most cerebral of ways, which is like not the way to hire office or any office in this country. So you got to have the rare combination of the intelligence, but then also that, the patina of charm with which to convey it, which is a rare combination to have. You know, it's like getting John and Paul in the same group. It just doesn't happen all that often. But if you do, I mean, that is, pretty much the, you got the entire road open to you at that point. I thought about the Kitzhaber thing, actually, after the fact. It was up on Belmont. There's a billboard, and it was put up there by the Republicans, and it just said, you may have seen this, it just said, ungovernable, in huge letters, in huge white letters. It said, ungovernable, and then it just said, it was like, Portland Republicans 2010 or something. And I saw it, and I actually thought that in a weird way, like, that might have worked for Kitzhaber, right? Because it's like, well, Christ, I don't want that job. I mean, it's like, well, what kind of man says that it's ungovernable and then says, but I'll do it, like I will take on the yoke of the
Tom Skerritt.
Yeah, that's I'm saying. Who. Yeah, a guy who says like it's an impossible task that I will shoulder for you like Sisyphus so that you may slumber, and that's, you look at that and you say, well, all right then, fair enough.
An odd career, Tom Skerritt.
I had a teacher one time who looked like Tom Skerritt. He scared the holy hell out of me for that reason, because he just seemed like a man who knew things and things that the average human shouldn't have access to.
Well, there's a fine line between Chris Cooper, not attractive, and Tom Skerritt is attractive.
Here's the thing about Chris Cooper is you look at Chris Cooper in Adaptation, and then you see him in normal life, and you realize they didn't have to do a whole lot to his teeth. to make it look that way. He's got teeth that look like he's just, you know, he's like he's one generation out of like Lick Skillet, Virginia or something. And it's just, and I find it unnerving in a way that I can't quite quantify.
It's a little like Luke Wilson that way. Like, good looking, but at the same time, you kind of like slightly inbred.
Well, something's wrong with you.
Yeah, there's a connection inside that isn't quite made all the way. There's a loose wire, at work somewhere there. We'll take a break here in just a moment. We'll have some headlines from Don Taylor. Mr. Mike Russell going to join us in a bit from culturepulp.com. He'll talk about his massive, extensive, encyclopedic interview with Mr. Berkeley Breathed, the creator and mastermind of Bloom County, among other things. Is there anything else going on in Portland that we ought to be aware of or that we ought to know, other than the vast number of clothing options apparently available to me downtown?
We are becoming very fashionable this city. It's fantastic.
Well, some of us are already there, Anna. We're just waiting for the others to catch up.
Who would that be?
I don't know. At the news desk, it's Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
We have a Geek Watch.
Here is your Geek Watch for Thursday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Ugh, this high-speed modem is intolerably slow.
In the Quasar Dilemma, remember, you used to...
It's just a television show. That's all, okay?
Right, but... Because we were wondering if the quantum flux... Now, just listen.
There is no quantum flux. There's no auxiliary. There's no goddamn shit. You got it?
Energize.
Here is Don Taylor with your Geek Watch for Thursday.
According to early estimates, Call of Duty Black Ops has become the fastest-selling game of all time, with over 7 million units sold on day one, following over 4.5 million pre-orders, as reported early in the week. If the 7 million for Black Ops holds true, it would make the launch around 10% larger than Modern Warfare 2 and the biggest of all time. Lending some extra weight to our estimations are reports that over 4 million users have now connected to Xbox Live to play Black Ops and similarly impressive figures via PSN. Breaking the data down, it's estimated that over 3.6 million units were sold in the U.S.,
Jesus.
1.4 million units in the U.K., over a million units in continental Europe, and 350,000 in Canada. Xbox 360 takes the largest proportion of sales with 59%, with 36% for PS3 and the remainder on PC, Wii, and
have you, DS. And I got to tell you, the night that game was released, I was sort of getting these, it was like counting the rings in a tree. I was getting these emails from listeners, listening at various places that were like, I'm camped out in line, again with the camping in line. I'm camping in line. I'm one person in the back. Woohoo, I got my game. And then about, I don't know, 8-9 hours later, if you ever, wonder what people are doing with their free time now that the economy has slowed again,
they're barely standing in line to buy cheap clothes and video games.
And to complete said video game, because it was like 8 or 9 hours later that I was getting a lot of, oh, I'm done! And they'd fought their way like to the end of the single player campaign or whatever. Have you seen any of the online marketing for this game?
I actually saw a commercial on TV for it the other night that was just terrific.
What is the TV campaign like? Because I haven't seen that.
It was all these different people, like children and housewives and ice cream men and Jimmy Kimmel, all running around in bombed out business buildings, shooting the hell out of each other.
That is fantastic.
It was great.
What music was on the soundtrack?
That I don't. I can't
because
tell you.
I'll tell you why I asked that question, because I really admire people who can do marketing and advertising in an innovative and creative way. I mean, that is its own rarefied kind of art form. The online advertising for this game has taken the form of just... We were talking the other day about the horror films, and it's sort of the scream and the laugh when you realize that they really just nailed you, that the filmmakers just got you and blindsided you totally and completely. So it is with advertising. There is a banner ad that has been on, I think, YouTube for the last couple of weeks, where it's so disturbing but so tantalizing and wonderful all at once. It is just a pump-action shotgun, and I think in variations it's also machine gun, that is just by itself floating, sort of just like untethered in open space at the top of the page. It's like a big black box, and inside, almost like a break glass in case of kind of a thing, is just the shotgun that's just sort of bobbing back and forth as though it's suspended in zero gravity. And it has sort of like a price tag hanging off the trigger. And the price tag, sort of mini pearl style, it just says, like, do not pull. And you just sit there and you look at it for a minute, and it's that whole thing in your head where you go, like, am I this easy to manipulate? The answer is yes. And, I click the trigger or whatever, and then the gun sort of, soups up and springs to life. And then the gun actually destroys other banner ads on the page, which I had not even really realized were there just to serve as targets. And then the actual ad proper begins to the blaring sounds of Gimme Shelter by the Rolling Stones. And it just shows guys like jumping off, you know, like the helicopter, like into the tall waving grass. And I was just like,
I must buy this.
Yeah, it's like they
I
just
have to buy this now, you said.
It's like they just root around in my head while I'm asleep. You know, like they just, you know, like they're just in the toy box of my brain going, I don't know, what do you got here? Rolling Stones likes to kill things, hates banner ads. What can we do with this? And the guy said, oh, let me, I'll be back in an hour. And they just created like the most effective ad I've ever seen in my freaking life.
The interesting thing about this to me is that looking at my Twitter feed the day before this came out, and I'm like looking at, I'm getting these little messages here and there on Twitter with people going, 8 hours to Black Ops, one more day to Black Ops, Steve, Black Ops. And the thing is, every single one of them was a woman. Every one of them. And I don't, you know, granted, I don't know a lot of gamer guys, but it was really impressive to me. It really, you know, drove home to me how many more women are actually playing these games now than ever before. Because they were all women that were excited about going and getting Black Ops.
It's funny. If you ever want to read a great piece of American electronic and pop cultural and technological history, there's a book that came out in 1993, I think, by a woman named J.C. And they did that thing of making her use the initials because boys don't buy books written by ladies. But her name is J.C. Hertz, H-E-R-Z. And she wrote a book, a title that seems really retrospectively cheesy, but it's a book called Joystick Nation. And it's all about the cultural impact of video games and whatever. And she devotes an exceptional amount of ink in this book to the then ongoing battle to get women to play video games and to get women to experiment with, you know, some of the new technology was coming out and how marketers and companies found it really difficult. But it's weird when you look back and you realize what an impossible task it seemed like at the time. It was just this mountain that couldn't be scaled. I really do think, and if my wife is any indication of this, I think that one of the things that actually really worked was making game systems that actually could be used for a lot of other things. Not that women aren't gamers. It's just that I think the dangling the prospect of the game itself was not enough of an inducement to try it. I think it is that once you can get somebody to try a video game system and to go like, well, this is awesome. This isn't, you know, because games have been marketed at guys and not just men, at guys for so long that I can see why a certain slice of the population will go, well, like, that holds no appeal to me. There's nothing about that I want to take part in. You know, but if then there's some other reason to use the system, then they've already got you in the house. And once you're in the house, then they can, you know, then they can get you on the games and you realize, like, this is awesome. This is fantastic. But, you know, it was just a matter of time. There was no way they were going to leave, like, 51% of the nation's income unobtained. But it is the idea that you would get, like, a Kristen Bowie type who undoubtedly is at home playing this game, like, as we speak is pretty, I mean.
Yeah, she knits and she wears, like, cute little hats. And she likes to blow things up.
Who doesn't like to blow things up?
I know.
It's satisfying.
It really is a glorious time to be alive. I mean, it really is just
I love living in the future.
No, as I often say, it's like yesterday sucks, today better, tomorrow better still. There's nothing about the past that is better than the now. Anybody tells you that, they are lying to you. They're peddling falsehoods to you. All right, is that the end of the Geek Watch?
That is indeed.
Before we close this out, by the way, and I won't say too much about this because it is a spoiler of just like the most unbelievable Gaussian proportions. There is once you get to the end of Black Ops, you want to stay all the way through the closing credits, and I'm going to tell you why. Now, some buzzkills have already started to release this sort of like, you know, via some of the tangential news organizations. But if you have not seen any of the recent news stories about Black Ops, try to avoid them until you get done with the game, until the closing credits of the game have finished, because you're going to be treated to what our friend Seamus described as the greatest thing that has ever existed in any realm of human existence. So there you go. You just a little tip from me to you. You find that at the end of your credits for Black Ops. There's your Geek Watch for Thursday, right here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
By Grabthar's hammer, by the sons of Warvan, I shall avenge you.
Next. Ooh, loneliness and cheeseburgers are a dangerous mix.
All right, we're going to do this on the other side. We'll talk to Mr. Mike Russell of CulturePulp.com. Also, Anna Griffin from The Oregonian will continue to spend quality time with us. We've got your Taser Watch still to come. Also, your Corpse Watch and more on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Indeed. All right. All right, this is the point where I would try to make some clever segue from the world of electronics and technology to Squire's Electric, but all of my creativity seems to have escaped me at the moment. So I will simply say that if you're listening to this program and you look toward the heaven occasionally and you thank the God of your understanding that such a quality compendium of amusements exists for you, and you say, how is it that I, a simple human, have access to such a cavalcade of laughs and wry observations? Who is it that makes this fine program possible? Well, of course, you do, by your generous support of the Rick Emerson program at the low, low cost of 32 cents a day, so low that it just seems patently unbelievable, frankly. I mean, even a little laughable. But also our fine business partners, including Squires Electric. You can find out more about Squires Electric at squireselectric.com, or you can go to 503-252-1609. That is 503-252-1609. Speaking of things that are ingrained part of the culture, so we are now, we're at the November 11th, means we're going to be getting to Thanksgiving, and then, after that, you're going to be, stringing the outside of your lights, with, sufficient illumination that you can be seen by Skylab, which is all well and good. Rick Emerson is heartily in favor of those kinds of things. I haven't put my decorations up, but I've done the thing of taking my Halloween decorations down, always a sad time, but then I put them back in the basement, and I took the Halloween, the boxes, and I replaced them. And then I took the Christmas decorations, and I put the boxes out so that they're, not buried in the back. They're sort of by the washer-dryer so that I have ready access to them.
Now, do you wait until Thanksgiving to decorate for Christmas?
No, not really. I mean, I've been known to decorate. Literally, I have been known to take down my Halloween decorations on November 1st and put up my Christmas decorations, November 2nd. I have no... Rick Emerson says no problem admitting this. Because Thanksgiving is just a dumb holiday. You know what Thanksgiving is? Thanksgiving is just, it is like all of the vague sort of amorphous brown stuff that surrounds all the Lucky Charms marshmallows. Like, it's there, and I guess it holds everything together. Like, it's a placeholder for the other stuff, but you don't really care about it that much. It's not like there's anything you're eating there or doing that you can't do the rest of the year except watching a balloon that's shaped like Snoopy crash into some school children somewhere. I mean, what the hell? Who cares? It's like a track on an album that gets between, the hit single and the hit ballad. You just remove that. You just skip right by it. So for me, I take the Halloween decorations down, and then it's like I just start getting myself into the pre-Christmas mode, which is a fact, because I'm just nuts for Christmas. I just love it. So I got the Christmas decorations. They're pulled out. And so now when I go down to, clean out the lint trap or something in the dryer, I see the Christmas decorations, and it just gives me a tiny little flicker of a warm glow in my heart.
Knowing that it's coming.
Yeah.
That it's on its way.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of
a pre-Christmas thing just for you.
Yeah, it is like, it's like perhaps some of you who imbibe adult beverages every now and again. It's like when you see the beer chilling in the freezer, you know what I mean? Or you see the, whatever, you see, your drink of choice on ice or
it's
being
like,
prepared.
It's like Christmas foreplay.
That's exactly what it is, in a sort of creepy, horrible, yes, no, maybe, I don't know. This has nothing to do with Squires Electric, who are paying for this ad, by the way. It's 503-252-1609. When it comes time to decorate the outside of your house, though, to string your lights, and if you got that whole thing where you got the whole animatronic, deer and the Grinch who's jumping out of a thing and falling off of whatever, and then you got lights in your window, you got lights on the tree, you get the heater running 24 hours a day, everybody else in your street's doing the same thing, don't be that one guy who says, no, one more string, and you plug him in and then nothing works anywhere, and your whole neighborhood is plunged into darkness and shame. Call Squires Electric, have them come check out your place, especially if it's the first Christmas you're spending there, the first winter you're spending there, or if it's a house that is, one of those houses built 60, 70 years ago, and you just, and it's got one outlet in the entire place because all you had to do was a thing that, the agitator for your under things. You just have them come and make sure that your electrical system is up to speed, and the same thing with your office as well. If it has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business, they can make your life exponentially easier. They are Squires Electric, 503-252-1609. Please tell me you heard it right here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program, won't you? Squires Electric.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Still to come, we got your Taser Watch, your Corpse Watch. And in just mere moments, we'll be joined by Mr. Mike Russell of CulturePulp.com. Don Taylor is tracking the following stories for you on this Thursday.
Well, there's the Taser Watch and the Corpse Watch. I mean, how much more time do I have for, you know?
You got all the time in the world, baby. You are Kronos.
Okay, well, I have the story about an Orlando theme park that promises they'll keep the noise down and people being a little bit unhappy with Conan O'Brien.
Excellent. It's 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick at rickemerson.com or Dawn, D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com. Our next guest is a writer, essayist, cartoonist, and Oregonian film critic. His musings on a variety of subjects can be read at culturepulp.com. He is also the conductor of one of the finest interviews that I have read in some time, that of Bloom County creator Berkeley Brevid, here to discuss that and more, and also to take the Rick Emerson Show guest examination, which Anna Griffin took a few weeks ago, by the way, is Mr. Mike Russell. Hello, sir.
I don't like the sound of that.
No, it's just like my... It's just... I'm sorry, Anna, your mic wasn't on there.
I said it's painless.
It is relatively painless. It's just... It's not even a Poorman. It's like my destitute man's James Lipton.
Well, I'm loaded up with Les Schwab popcorn from this afternoon, so I'm ready to go.
Is that code for something?
No, you go to Les Schwab. They got the little popcorn machine. Little bags with labeled with the Les Schwab logo.
There's free popcorn at Les Schwab when you get
bastard.
Your car.
What Les Schwab do you go to?
All of them.
Any of them.
They all have popcorn.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, I just went to... Okay, here's the thing, and I should say, by the way, just for the record, just a little bit of a prelude. I had exceptional service there. I didn't even get a chance to tell the story, because I think it was one of those things... I think it was one of those stories I was going to tell, but then it's like... I don't know. You were on the way to work, and you, like, I don't know, you hit an elk or something with your... Because something happened, and it, like... But it like, preempted all the other things we were going to tell about. What did we do last night? But I had this thing where I had to get my brakes taken care of. You know, because my wife was out of town. I was taking advantage of the fact that I had two cars and whatever. So I was having my brakes taken care of, and our good friend Scott Landerville, his fine business, you know, he dropped my car off, and they, you know, they took care of the brakes. And then he did the thing of, you know, they bring the car back, because I was in Beaverton doing Outlook Portland. So they bring the car back. And he says, "Oh, and by the way," he's like, "we don't do this. So you'll want to go to Les Schwab or someplace." But he's like, "You want to get these? You want to get your back two tires taken care of?" And I just looked, and it was that thing. And he'd taken a photo and sent it to my phone, just like in case I didn't bother to look myself. But it's the thing where, like, the metal tread was actually showing through, and that is the kind of tire that is typically accompanied by the statement, "Well, legally, I'm not even supposed to let you drive out of the shop on these because you're taking your life in your hands." So, and he told me, he was like, and the thing about Scott is, you know, Scott, he's very. Like, he's not a man who is prone to overstay, but if he says something about your car, like, it's not because he's trying to hork $50 out of you. Like, it's true. And he said, "So, like, if you know any back roads on the way home where you can go maybe 20 miles an hour, I mean, if you can do that, it'd be great, because I'd hate for these to explode underneath your car." Anyway, so I went to Les Schwab, and they were really great. They were handy. Took care of it promptly and efficiently. But I remember no popcorn. So I wonder if that is a thing that... Are we in Southeast Portland denied free?
I was just at the one on Southeast Division.
Really?
There was popcorn, and the young men sprinting back and forth, you know, to get your vehicle. Yeah. Oh, it was so great.
Yeah, I went. The great thing about Les Schwab is if you have like a hole in your tire, you get a screw in your tire and nails. If you take it, I got this nail in my tire, and they will do it for free.
No, they really
fix it for you. And they have like a big flat screen TV, and I was watching Law and Order reruns, and they had Wi-Fi, and there's free popcorn. It's awesome.
I really have to say, and I only say this because it's true, it is a fantastic business. I've always had exceptional service there. You know, I've talked to people like, "I got a flat tire," and like, Les Schwab, because it's like, even, you know, half the time it's like you just go in there and they're like, you know, "Come back and get your tires here. This is fine. You're good to go." And
maybe when you were there, you didn't see the popcorn machine because it was obscured by the stack of free beef.
Okay, no, that's entirely true. Because they do the whole thing of, like, you getting the side of beef if you buy the thing. Yeah. What do you have to buy to get the beef?
Tires.
But, I mean, how many? Like, just two? Four?
You have to buy four tires.
Ah, too late, I realized the error of my purchase.
Do you have a vegetarian option?
No, I was going to say something, even by this show's standards, I was going to say, we've known each other, but not quite long enough for me to say what I was going to, make a snarky vegetarian comment that I rescinded. It was like the Gmail recall thing where you hit it and it doesn't send the email. I was going to make a snarky vegetarian comment,
the relationship is still too new.
I'm just saying, you know, you and I, Anna and I have known each other for, I don't know, when's the last time you came on the Outlook Portland, or first time rather? When is it, like a year ago?
It's been more than a year now.
All right. Well, at some point I'll just make the leap and do, you know, into treating you like I treat everybody else. And then we'll see how much longer things last after that. Mike Russell, so you, people have heard you on Court and Fat Boy, and also you've written, you know, film reviews for The Oregonian and Culture Pulp, which is also a comic.
Yeah.
And a website and a sort of an everything. To
I do a comic strip occasionally for The Oregonian called Culture Pulp. It's also online. It is a strip in which I go and do things, and then I do a strip about it, in which I am the lead cartoon character.
So when did you, how did this thing of you doing the interview with, and it is Breathed, right? I've said that my whole life, but that, is that right? Is it
Breathed, yeah.
Breathed, okay. How is it that you came to be doing an interview with that guy? Because he's, I mean, he's not like J.D. Salinger or something, but it's not like he's
no, he doesn't do that many interviews.
It yeah.
was, I was, it actually, funny enough, because he's a bit of a Luddite. He hates, like, all the social media. The reason I got to interview him was because of Twitter.
Because is it because you were did you send a message or did you say something about is it one of those things where you said something about him and then lo and behold like here's a message? You
know? It's actually there's a chain of events. If you have a second,
yeah.
What happened is that I the Bloom IDW Publishing is releasing this 5-volume series of The Complete Bloom County. Well, I first day came out and picked up the first book in that series and I'm sitting at home reading it. And I noticed that in a book of like 600 strips, so let's put this in perspective, you know, the top tier, on the Sundays, the top panel that often
right.
gets left out of Sunday papers, two of them had missing art. And so
when you say missing art, you mean it was just the words or they just weren't there?
They had photoshopped in something, you know, to sort of compensate, but they did not have the actual art that
okay.
had originally
All
run.
Right. Okay.
And so not knowing the reason why, I simply took a picture of it with my cell phone and posted it to Twitter. And maybe put at reply IDW Publishing
right.
on it. And
like, what is up with this?
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, not so complete after all, I think was like my snarky ass comment. But then the next, this is what's awesome. The next morning, I wake up and I check my email and hi, this is Scott Dunbeer. I'm the editor of those books. Why don't you give me a call?
Wow.
And I was like, okay.
So you were the first person who noticed or the first person who noticed and said so publicly?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
when I say were they aware, they obviously did, but I mean, was that known? Was that a thing that the whole company, that they knew when they put the book out? Or was it like a thing that like they did in the art department because they realized, oh my God, the book is due tomorrow. We don't have it. What do we have in Photoshop?
Well,
like, did the publishers know it?
Yeah, yeah. What I found out is I called him figuring I was either in for a good bollocking or a great story. And I basically talked to him and he goes, so here's what's going on. First he goes, my nemesis. And then he goes, and then he proceeds to be very nice and tell me what happened. What had happened is that the publisher's proofs, particularly for the earlier strips, had gone missing. They had been loaned to some company that was
right.
doing an online version of the strips and had never been returned. So he was having to assemble this Complete Bloom County from things like having to go to the library and scan in microfiche in
wow.
some cases. Because, you know, they'd never at all been collected in a book before. Loose Tales, the first Little Brown collection, starts, you know, really skips a lot of the earliest stuff that Bloom County did.
It is so weird to me even, I mean, especially now, because, I mean, Bloom County started, what, in the early 80s? Or the
81, I believe.
But, I mean, you know, that's late enough in the, you know, in the technological game that you think they would have had, there had already at that point been enough instances of things being irretrievably lost.
Right.
Because they said, well, the Milton Berle show, who needs this? And then they would just erase it to put, like, you know, My Little Margie or something on it.
Right.
It's astounding that they didn't just have a big vault somewhere with all those things in it.
Yeah, no, apparently the analog copies of this were not as well under lock and key as they should have been. So what happened was is that Dunbeer had done his very best. I think it's a pretty impressive collection. But he told me what happened. And then somehow during this conversation, I talked him into letting me interview him about this. Because the story of the scavenger hunt had not really been told.
Right.
And so we did it for Ain't It Cool News, and we went on and on about it, and it was well received. And then later on he goes, well, that went okay. You want to interview Berkeley Breathed?
Wow.
And which was like, yeah, I guess my reward for that not going poorly. And so being a smartass on Twitter led to this interview, which was really strange.
I have to ask this. When he asked you, do you want to interview Berkeley Breathed, was it over the phone? Did he ask you this over the phone or via, like, email or whatever?
I think the first mention I got of it was email. And
did you do a little...
I actually went into a complete state of, as far as addressing that option... I went into paralysis for literally a couple of months.
Like,
I
just don't know.
Yeah,
what do you say? did he do one of those introductions, like, you know, Berkeley, meet Mike. Mike, meet Berkeley. Or how did it?
Yeah, I received an email that was sent to me and Berkeley Breathed, and it was, hey, Scott Dunbier said it. He said, here, the Berkeley Breath, this guy's all right. Why don't we do an interview to support Volume 3?
Wow.
And so I went, great. And this is also kind of funny. I actually accidentally stepped in it in my very first ever email exchange with him. I had said, well, thank you, Mr. Breathitt. Here are some other interviews I've done to give you an idea what I'm about. And I sent my James Cameron interview I did recently to him. And he writes back, Breathitt writes back right away, and he goes, hey, that's great. You know, in the James Cameron interview, I had compared Avatar favorably to the Polar Express, calling it, I believe, that horrible Polar Express movie. And the first email back, Breathitt goes, is, yeah, I'm looking forward to the interview. I'm actually doing a movie with Zemeckis now, too, so you'll have a new thing to judge.
Oh, wow.
which was like, oh.
And yeah, but you weren't wrong.
I've been doing this long enough that I actually am capable of finding that funny rolling with the awkwardness just embraced
but
it.
But you just never know, especially if it's a guy who you've never interviewed and who doesn't do a lot of interviews. So it's like you don't really know what he's like. I mean, maybe you've seen him do interviews with other people, but you never know. If he's just become some curmudgeon, or if he's become a likable, or if I've done interviews with people where I'm like, this guy's going to be awesome. I've seen he's hilarious, and then you just get him in the room, and this is my first interview with Henry Rollins, which was terrifying anyway because he's like he could beat me to dust, and it was like somebody like the last DJ he talked to was not asking the right questions because everything he did that day was like a one syllable response. And it was just terrible. Oh. And I just left going I should never have said yes to this. So I know that the stress of that. Let me go back a second and ask you, when was your first exposure to Bloom County, just as a reader? When did you first discover that?
Boy, I was probably like 12, 13. It got into the Oregonian maybe a year after it actually debuted, which if you've read the first year of Bloom County in this complete collection, is probably just as well, because literally the cast was different. Completely changed over the course of about a year.
Was it the first trip he'd done, really, of any?
He did a college comics trip called the Academia Waltz for 2 years, which is what got him the job. I guess he actually used the Academia Waltz, like publishing trade collections of it, to pay for his college education or something, or at least part of it.
When you saw Bloom County, so you're 13, did you realize at the time how different or how subversive it kind of was?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody did our age. I think that... the thing that it struck me was, and this is something I actually in the intro to my Breathitt interview was reading it next to like Marmaduke and Heathcliff, and felt like you were getting away with something,
right?
Because this was a comic that was definitely a lot more anarchic, a lot more reckless, a lot less politically correct, although maybe not less politically correct than The Wizard of Id, on purpose. But but I think that one of the things that really struck me is the only time I'd ever seen like Looney Tunes comic energy captured in a comic newspaper page.
It's interesting that you say the getting away with something, because I don't know that I would have been able to form it that clearly. But in retrospect, I think it was on some level I had the whole like, do they know this is in the paper? Like,
right.
It was almost like a guy was slipping it into the last moment. You know, ipsum lorem, Bloom County, and then just right before it went off, and it's because it didn't. And anarchic is it seemed like it was barely restrained. Like at any moment, the panels might just sort of explode. I have to ask, just on behalf of the people who've seen your stuff, what influence, if any, did the strip or did Breathitt have on you?
Oh, I mean, everybody who was – I did a college comic strip myself, nowhere near as good as the Academia Waltz. But, I mean, like everybody I knew at that time who was doing a college comic strip, we were just nakedly ripping off Bloom County's comic beats.
Your college character, Hairless Cat, is a very, very
– The Hairless Cat, yeah. Such and such killed the Hairless Cat, yeah.
You had a line in this interview, and we'll talk more about his responses here in a second, where you refer – and I wrote this down – You referred to Berkeley Breathitt, Bill Watterson, and Gary Larson as the last truly comedically badass trio of newspaper cartoonists. First of all, what makes those three guys so distinct to you?
Well, the interesting thing about them is it's a real weird thing where all three of them are kind of doing their thing at the same time.
Was that a coincidence, do you think? Or was it, in other words, was it just happenstance? Or was there some confluence of events that led to those three guys doing that at that time?
I think it's happenstance, but it's interesting because they share a lot in common. All three of them quit their strip after 10 years, so they never let it get stale. They're all three friends and correspond with each other. In fact, Breathitt actually coached Larson on how to get his copyright back, as I understand it.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, and then they all but they all did come at it from very different sensibilities. I mean, Watterson was a lifetime comics fan. He was a student of the comics art form, and Breathitt is kind of the opposite. He actually doesn't read comic strips.
But their stuff is also, all three, deeply, deeply intelligent.
Yeah. It's written first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which sets it way apart from everything else you see on the comics page.
Yeah, they all three led with their writing, which is interesting. I think it really, it's a sort of a peak time for that art form in terms of, and maybe not in terms of artistically, because 1920s newspaper comics are unbelievably gorgeous, but in terms of just, they, all three of those guys had sort of mastered, in a writing sense, the form in all three in very different ways. I, in my intro to my Breathed interview, I make the comparison of, like, I think if Watterson is Disney Studios, Breathed is sort of Termite Terrace.
Right.
And sort of you sort of had this wonderful series of perspectives on comics.
Maybe, and also that they have been, growing up as comics, you know, the best satire of any art form always comes from people who love the art form, because yeah. you got to know the thing to satirize the thing, you know, and to do it well, because, you know, any great satire has a little bit of, you know, has a little bit of love in it, sometimes more than a little bit, because otherwise you just end up being like, you know, you just end up being like a, you know, some cheap shot Family Guy joke. But you look at Breathed, and that's a guy who clearly loves art and loves a certain kind of humor so much that he can sort of turn it inside out. Not unlike a guy like Joss Whedon, who clearly grew up watching formulaic television,
sure.
but loved it in a weird way, but knows how to subvert those formulas. It's like he knows the setup and the punchline so well that he can then circumvent it and give you something you're not quite expecting.
Well, isn't it interesting that Whedon's a second-generation TV writer? His dad wrote the formula TV.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes a lot of sense, actually, because he would have internalized those rhythms early on, and then you know how you can screw with them and how you can't. And still have the thing work. Was there a plan among the three of them to quit at the same time, basically?
No, not that I'm aware of, actually. There may be.
Did one influence the other, you think? Because who bailed out first of the three?
I believe it was Breathed that bailed out first.
And I wonder if that was sort of an indication to the others of like, oh, he's got a good idea there.
He might have been the leader on that one. I link in the interview to some correspondence that Breathed and Watterson were having. And Watterson is teasing Breathed in all these letters. Breathed showed this stuff off at Comic-Con this year. Watterson is always teasing Breathed for having quit and just is sort of living on his pile of money and for urging Watterson to do the same.
We're talking to Mr. Mike Russell of CulturePulp.com about his interview with Berkeley Breathed, the man behind Bloom County. Well, you sent him a bunch of questions. I mean, I've seen his response. I mean, it's voluminous. I mean, he just goes on and on. Were you surprised that he actually said, like, I will respond to everything?
That was shocking to me because, you know, what happened was is I was paralyzed for a little while and kind of got my act together. And then when I finally came down to write the questions, you know, sometimes there are people who loom so large in your legend, you don't know what to ask. You're like, it's just like, oh, it's so monumental. Finally, the system I came up with was I just read every interview he'd ever given, which isn't that many,
right.
and that I could find. And then I asked follow-up questions to his answers to those.
Excellent.
And what happened is I sent him, I'd sent him like 60 questions. And I wrote him an email. I said, these are way too many questions. Just answer as many or few as you'd like. And then I got back an email with like 20, 30 answers. And he goes, I'm not done yet. And then I got another email back with 10 more answers. And I was like, oh, my God.
So you got with a lot of free time, or is it just
I mean,
not that your questions weren't great, but I mean, it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, I always get the sense he doesn't like talking about
he
the
doesn't
strip.
Like he insists on email interviews. He doesn't like talking about it for sure. It's what I've gathered anyway.
Here's a dumb question. So you get he creates Bloom County. It runs for however many years? I mean, not counting Opus and Outlander, or whatever. It ran for what? I don't know. 15,
about 10 years. 15? 10 years. I mean, 80 to 89, I believe, is what it was. Or 81 to 89.
If he doesn't read comics, and if he doesn't, you know, and if he's a guy who is, he seems totally unimpressed by fame and by whatever. Is he even aware of the impact that it's had? I mean, maybe until very recently anyway. I mean, did he just, like, live his life, like, not even really knowing?
Well, he was aware of the checks.
Well,
so
fair enough.
I think that probably was a good indicator for him. But yeah, no, it is interesting. He does express that he was fairly overwhelmed by the response at Comic-Con. And for years in interviews, people would say, when are you going to do an omnibus of all the Bloom County
right.
strips, like they did with The Far Side and Calvin and Hobbes? And he would always say, oh, nobody wants to read that. And then we'd just be like, he'd say all the pop culture references are dated. No one cares who Edwin Meese is now, you know. And it's kind of funny because then somehow Scott Dunbier talks him into it. Yeah, I mean, Bertha Breth had owned the copyright. Who could have done this any time?
Was he? Because he discontinued all the. I remember the, when I was a child, there was just you were up to your eyeballs in Bloom County merchandise everywhere you went. It's like shirts and whatever. And I own one piece of Bloom County merchandise at this point. I have a "Don't Blame Me, I Voted for Bill and Opus" shirt, which I keep in a Brink's Vault kind of a like climate controlled thing underneath Boulder, Colorado,
sure.
Behind layers of granite. But he pulled the plug on all that stuff at a certain point, right? He was just like, F it, I don't want to merchandise this stuff anymore.
Yeah, he didn't have Watterson's allergy to merchandising. But
he did, I think he pulled the plug on it, though, at a certain point. Or maybe I'm just making that up in my head.
Yeah, I should know this. I interviewed him, and I don't know.
Yeah, and maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe it's just that they just stopped carrying it wherever I was shopping or living at the time. But it seemed like it's pre-internet, so maybe it was just a thing that we heard, and maybe it wasn't true. But it seemed like one day there was all of this Bloom County stuff, and the next day, I think, with the exception of like reprints of the material itself, like some of the strips and the whatever, the merchandise just was gone.
Yeah, they kind of dried up. I don't know why. Probably was just because the strip was over. I'm surprised though that when he brought back Opus, from 2003 to 2008. That he didn't actually bring back an Opus plushie.
What was the reason? Because he did Bloom County, and then he did Outland with Ronald Ann, and then he did Opus. So every time it's like he would leave and come back and leave and come back. What was the reason for coming back? Maybe in just the Sunday format. And what was the reason for quitting again?
I don't know on Outland. I think that he was. I think on Outland he was tired of doing it daily. The grind got to him, and then he probably just wanted to do Sundays. I don't know why he quit Outland. I know with Opus, what happened was my suspicion is the reason he started Opus is because there was an Opus movie development deal with the Weinsteins, and he wanted to keep the name
really?
Alive. That would be my guess. I don't know if that's true. I would imagine that at least partially figured into his calculations, although I don't – again, this is just me speculating.
Did Opus ever talk – was there like a TV special where Opus spoke?
There was one TV special
I think where he finds his mom or something.
It was A Wish for Wings That Work. It was produced by Steven Spielberg and has an uncredited voice by Robin Williams.
Is it good?
Yeah. That actually is not terrible. I mean it's not great. It's always – to me it's always hard when you see something like this when you've imagined – the voices and the gestures
right.
and the facial expressions of something that's static like a comic strip for so long that when you actually hear who they've chosen to do a voice, it's almost always wrong.
Any voice for Opus would seem wrong, probably. Yeah.
And well, they can't all be what's his name? He did the voice of Garfield.
Right.
Who was the guy that did the voice?
Lorenzo Music.
That was NC. That was just NC. Now it was just like unbelievably dated reference at this point. Do they still make? I mean, they still run the Garfield strip, but I wonder if they still actually make those like collections. I wonder if there are actually hardcore Garfield fans that are still like
The thing is, the animated Garfield cartoon was so much better
than
great. The strip.
It was not bad at all. It was really, really good. You know what else is good? Is a little, comparatively speaking, a little watched, underappreciated cartoon was the Heathcliff cartoon that had Mel Blanc doing the voice of Heathcliff.
Never seen that.
No, it was because you had to, it was big on the East Coast, and it was, I only got to see it, we were talking about this the other day, actually, with the guy who made Space Battleship Yamato died, Star Blazers, and how that was a regional thing that we got in my hometown because it came out of Seattle, on a Seattle station before cable, they would just pipe in signals from across the country. In Kennewick, we got WGN out of Chicago, and WGN aired the Heathcliff cartoon because Heathcliff is he was an East Coast phenomenon or an eastern part of the United States phenomenon in some ways. And Mel Blanc did the voice of Heathcliff, and it was not bad. I mean, it wasn't groundbreaking, but it was actually pretty good. So Anna Griffin is here as well, and you guys are both in the newspaper game, as they say. So to whatever extent, I mean, like, do people? How do I put this? Do people care about the comic strip the way they used to? Even if the numbers are different, even if the percentage of people looking at the comics page is maybe not the same as it used to be, because so much is online and whatever. Do people care about it as much as they used to?
You do not mess with people's comics.
Is that true?
Yeah.
You hear those anecdotes from the newspaper, like, well, we tried to move High and Lois, and then it's like there was a lynch mob outside or whatever.
I would refine that to say you do not mess with people's comics. You have to make them smaller and smaller and smaller. That would be my – I mean this is not me criticizing just any our newspaper but all newspapers. Well, I think they've made comic strips so tiny there. They can't breathe. It's interesting reading the Bloom County collection because the four. It's the classic four panel, you
right.
know, that Peanuts also did well. And it's interesting because reading it now, that seems like luxurious space.
That was one of the reasons. Didn't Breathed have issued some demand that his strip couldn't be shrunk or reduced?
Yes, when he started and to finish the anecdote about Opus, when he started Opus in I think it was 2003, he did have a contractual stipulation initially that it had to run with all three tiers. And he actually composed in that space really
right.
beautifully. It had to run big. That was lifted over time when it didn't quite make the seismic splash they might have been predicting, or maybe, you know, it just whatever concessions were going on there. It ends up getting smaller and less colorful as it goes along.
In terms of traditional, you know, newspaper comic strips, you know, things that are running there between, like, Aces on Bridge and, you know, whatever, Gene Dixon or whatever else is on that page, is there anything...
Aces on Bridge, man.
Well, you know, it's like the whole... We used to do this.
The jumble,
right next to the Omar Sharif column.
we used to do this bit that we should that I should bring back at some point, where I would just I would just read Aces on Bridge, but I would put Miles Davis underneath it, and I would just kind of do like a snap. And it just, I swear to God, it just sounds like a Ginsberg poem. It's just like, you know, trick to the dummy in spades to the four east, flip the heart to the guest, take it, you know. And it was just Moloch the Destroyer. It was all very like weird, yeah. And it's, you know, and if you just do that with like a Coltrane in the background, it works. You could take that to the East Village, you'd be a god. But is there anything either old or new, but primarily new, happening on the comics page that is, even if it's not as good as Bloom County, is there anything good and interesting and fresh happening on the comic strip page now, in that traditional newspaper page?
I would say that, you know, the Get Fuzzy, I think, enjoys a certain acclaim. It's probably in the same family. I think that, but Get Fuzzy is interesting because I would always call its comedy a comedy of tone more than actual punchlines. It's more like, oh, there's a vibe in this strip that's kind of amusing and makes me smile wryly. It doesn't blow me away like things aren't exploding in it
right.
like they used to in Bloom County.
It's as somebody said about NPR, it's smile funny, not laugh funny.
Right. Well, that's an interesting way to put
right.
that, isn't it?
I myself am a big fan of Foxtrot. Although I got to tell you, I actually read it online, and occasionally I'll go pick up like the enormously Foxtrot Volume 5 or something. And as ham-handed as it was in some ways, I was a huge fan of Boondocks.
Sure.
Because
yeah.
it was, and he used a cudgel as opposed to a rapier. I mean, he was, you know, Aaron Magruder was nobody's idea of subtle. I mean, he really made Breathed look refined and restrained. He just took a hammer to things. But there were moments where he was really, really good. And just to tie all this up, and then we'll do some more news and some whatever. And here's the thing about the show. You may have noticed that it's on the Emerson News Network, so there's no one to make me stop. So I'll just talk until you guys, like, it'll be like an airplane, pan back and just be skeletons, like, in the chair, or, like, you'll be dangling from a noose, and I'll be going, and, like, the Howls had all this luggage for just 3 hours. What is up with that? And blah, 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 you know, and pop culture reference 75, and, you know, and just, like, babbling. So, you know.
You know,
I
was going to say, we also still, at some point, need to break out our serial killer trivia cards. To ask our guests serial killer trivia.
Here's my read on the room is that one of the fine guests might enjoy that. The other of the fine guests might find it off-putting and even a trifle unnerving and may choose not to return if we bring out the...
I'm pretty squeamish.
Is the box over here?
I don't know. What did you had it?
Hold on. Let me see
what
the cover of the box is actually. I'll see if I can dig it up. I think I've actually got the box and I'll show it to you because it's awesome. So we'll do some news here in just a second and so forth and continue to get y'all's observations on the issues of the day. My final question, at least for now, on this and the whole Berkeley Brother thing. And by the way, and is it all readable at culturepulp.com or at Ain't It Cool? Or where can the whole interview kind of be read?
If you go to my website, culturepulp.com, culturepulp.com, you will find a link to the Breathed interview. It's
right.
it's off the front page of Ain't It Cool News. That's the best place to find it.
And
right
it's like
now.
In three parts. I mean, it's pretty...
It was just one epic...
Oh, really? Just
epic
long, giant.
We also had a follow-up contest where we gave three signed books to people who could make up their own accurate Billy and the Boingers song title.
Awesome. I lied. I've got a question and a half. One is, you may have answered this already, but what is Brother doing now? And is it like, is he going to return in a print form at least to these characters, these strips at any point?
I believe he is done for good with doing newspaper comics based on the statements he was making in the interview I did with him. Which were like might as well just pouring propellant on the bridge,
right.
you know, with a torch in your hand.
Well, he seemed very bitter. I mean, not bitter is the wrong way to put it. He seems a reflexively skeptical / cynical guy.
Well, it's funny because he I think that some of that is I don't know. Some of it's just him just being funny. It's interesting because when I was doing the email interview with him, I sent him an assembly of the interview, and he looked at it, and he goes, "Mike, I'm gonna take this back from you and spice it up a little." And I got it back 1,000 words longer.
Wow.
With all this dark humor that you're responding to added to his answers, which was pretty awesome.
And this is something I was going to ask you a couple questions back, but I'll wrap it up because it brings us to the Aaron Magruder thing, who in a big way, and this was made even more obvious when he did the animated version of the Boondocks,
right.
Where that guy owes a huge debt, obviously, to Charles Schulz in terms of tone and style in some ways, and. You know, and Breathed, like so many of those guys, just speaks in these glowing, reverential tones about Peanuts and about Charles Schulz. It's so hard to ask this because it makes me feel like a bad American and a bad person. But is that to some degree just because it's conventional wisdom that you got to say it?
You must pay your...
Yeah.
No, actually, with him, I don't think so. I was actually thinking about that, and I don't think so. Because if you look at the history of Bloom County, he makes fun of almost every contemporary American comic strip happening at the time. He makes a lot of fun of Doonesbury with his alternate universe version of Doonesbury, those darn cats.
Do those guys dislike each other somehow? Is there some sort of feud?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, not anymore, but what happened is that Breathed, in the early days of his strip, very nakedly warmed over a joke idea from Doonesbury, and Trudeau called him on it.
Well, and his early drawing style was very much Trudeau as well. He was very obviously modeling his own comic, his stylistically on Trudeau.
Trudeau very kindly, gently, or maybe not so gently, was pointing that out. In fact, I think it was a bone of contention when Breathed won a Pulitzer in 87.
I bet that went over well.
The editorial cartoonists of the world were very upset about it, and I think it was partly because of Trudeau.
Well, Trudeau seems like a dick anyway. I mean, I hate to say that. He just seems like an ass. He really just seems – whenever I read Doonesbury, and maybe this says more about me than Gary Trudeau, but I don't think I'm alone in this. Whenever I read Doonesbury, I get that sense of like the guy who thinks he's slightly and sometimes more than slightly better than the audience that he's performing for. I read Doonesbury and sometimes – and it's like – you know the thing with Doonesbury? Doonesbury is like Dane Cook in that you look at it – and I'm the first person in the history of the world to say that, by the way. But it's the same thing. The same phenomenon happens with Doonesbury strips as with Dane Cook, where I'll read it and then I'll go, well, I got to go back. I think I missed the joke. Hold on. No, there's – oh my God! There are no. I think I got a. It's like when you buy a bad bag of breakfast cereal and it's no prize. It's like occasionally I just look and I go, I think I got the bad paper. There's no joke in this Doonesbury. And so it is with Dane Cook. I'll listen back to it and I'll go, no, there was no actual humor to be found there. It was just a thing he said that I was supposed to laugh at, I guess. And
yeah,
so
at
that's
least with Sally Forth, you get that wry smile where they look at each other.
Damn.
I mean, come on, you know.
On that note, here is Don Taylor at the news desk.
And now from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
The Carnival Splendor cruise ship limped into San Diego Harbor this morning after a fire in the engine room knocked out power earlier this week, stranding the 4,500 people on board without hot food or functioning toilets.
In a living hell of sunbathing off the coast of Mexico.
For the past 3 days, passengers have been living off spam, canned crab meat, and Pop-Tarts, and weren't able to use their cell phones or air conditioners.
Times is hard.
There were also less pleasant issues. People were getting upset by the toilet situation, said passenger Danny Cole to CBS. They couldn't flush, and there's quite a big smell issue on the ship.
You're at sea. The world is your toilet. The world is your John. There was this soundbite we had yesterday from this woman who just, just a moment, it's like, you know, her name is like Cindy with an I at the end of it, and like a little heart drawn over it. And she was talking, it was just something in the tone. And she was one of those people, she did the upward inflection at the end of every word, too. And she was talking about just like what a horrible, you know, like.
It just isn't right that people should have to live in these conditions.
Seriously, it's like she was in a refugee camp in Hungary or something. And as Dom, pointed out, and I'm kind of lifting your line there, you say, you're just camping. You're camping on a cruise ship. Like off the coast of Mexico, and then like sort of shot of it, it's like sparkling seas and crystal blue skies, and people just laying on chairs and going, oh, I don't know, should I have blueberry or strawberry pop tarts today, Muffy? And and it's like you're talking to her, and it's like she's in Rwanda or something.
Yeah, they are Chilean miners, for God's sakes. They're
Jesus.
On a cruise ship.
Ugh.
Why do they have spam?
Why do they have spam on the cruise ship?
I can answer that. Because they were going later as one of their ports of call to Hawaii, and therefore probably picking up Hawaiian passengers. And Hawaiians are crazy for spam. And that is not just a cultural stereotype. That is true. Hawaiians love spam. You talk to Cheryl. Cheryl go on and on about, they're a spam-loving folk.
Why?
Because they have I know the answer to that too, perversely enough.
We're just going to keep this up all afternoon.
You can just daisy chain these together like a Rube Goldberg conversation. This is a thing, I believe the reason for this is twofold. One, because there's a strong, there's the strong Asian influence and the strong, there's sort of the Polynesian thing happening. And Asian culture in general, I believe actually, spam sells much better in Asian countries and Asian parts of the world than here, generally speaking. Also, because during World War II, there was a lot of stationing of servicemen in Hawaii, and the Army loved spam because it kept forever. Because you could just stick, give a guy spam, and it would just last, forever. It was like basically, they were like preserved rations, essentially. And so as a residual effect of that, you have a whole generation or multiple generations that have grown up in Hawaii, with a love of spam because it's what dad ate. And so dad was, started making it first when we were kids, and now we eat it.
Yeah, it's on restaurant menus.
As a weird or funny, wacky item. I mean, it's like as a legitimately upscale dish in some cases, depending on how it's prepared.
There's a disproportionately high intake of spam per capita in Hawaii than anywhere else in the United States.
Yeah, we used to work with a guy, Don and I used to work with a guy at the Clackamas Review named David Strupe, who was from Hawaii, and we can confirm this information.
Yes.
Yeah, no, she's got the whole like spam cookbook, which is not like, Ohio and like a wacky Jane and Michael Stern, roadside cookbook. It's like a thing that they, here's another product that's the case with. Certain parts of the world, they're that way about Cheese Whiz. Because Cheese Whiz is apparently, considered, I don't know if delicacy is the right way to put it, but it is not viewed the same way in some locales as it is through much of America.
I hear it's huge in the Republic of Chad.
Wow.
Huge.
Well, the Carnival Splendor officials have shown their sorrow to these poor people who had to live in these horrible conditions off the coast of Mexico on a cruise ship. Giving them a full refund as well as a coupon for another free cruise.
Awesome. I love it when people who get something they're not happy with are given more of that same thing.
Yeah.
Nothing ever makes me happier than a story in which, and after recovering from ptomaine poisoning, he was given an all-you-can-eat coupon for...
I know how much you hated this cruise where you got stranded and there were overflowing toilets and no cold water and no warm food. So here, try it again. Come back and try it again later.
And that sort of apology is designed for guys like me because I'm just such a freaking tightwad that I would totally take it. That's the thing. And I would use it. It doesn't matter. It's like I am that guy who's like, you can't throw it away. It's worth something. I have to use it now.
What's the whole Little Caesars pizza theory? It's like their pizza is really, really terrible, but you get two.
Right. Well, see also the McRib unpleasantness from slightly earlier this week. All right, I'm just mentioning it. I'm not going to dwell, you understand. Here's Don Taylor. That's going to get mentioned like once a week, by the way, for as long as we do the show.
I have a corpse watch.
Okay. Here is your corpse watch for Thursday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones. Exhuming things that's better left alone. But I'm resurrecting memories.
You know that McRib was hard as a rock.
Okay, first of all,
it was dead. It was 4 days in the fridge.
Here's the thing.
It was inedible.
I have three responses to that. One, that's a subjective assessment, and my view of what constitutes hard as a rock might be different than yours. Secondly, I have only your word to go on because I didn't get a chance to examine the McRib before you threw it away. And thirdly, fourthly, even if it was hard as a rock, that's a thing I can fix. Thirdly, that would not stop me from eating it anyway, even if it was not fixable, because, it's like half a sandwich. You don't throw half a sandwich away.
You can spray paint over mold, so you're not looking at it anymore either. That doesn't mean it's edible.
Don't be foolish. You scrape the mold off to whatever extent you can, or feed it to the dog or something. They don't know any better. I'm just saying, you put it... Mike Russell. Now, here's a question. Are you, are you single, married, together? You're a married man. Okay, but you spend time in a house of dudes or just a house of yourself. If you got something that's like, bread or pizza or something, it's stale, you put it in the microwave, softens up. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes with a mug of water, if you really need to, and then it's spongy and full of life once again. So the thing with the McRib
is like sea monkeys. You just add water and it comes back to life.
Exactly. Or like that corpse flower, you know, that just dies and then it's, you know, it's like a, it's like an, it's like a, it's like a culinary cicada. You know, it's gone, but then you return it to its full splendor and then I eat it. I mean, or I would have if it hadn't been thrown away into the trash. And I was 5 feet away is the other thing. You're there. I'm here. You can see me from where you were throwing it away.
I'm sorry it did not occur
you
to
basically,
me.
I mean, you had to do everything
you actually
but
wanted
step
to eat the 4-day-old stale half-eaten McRib.
All right, fine. Okay.
You know, our guests don't like it when mommy and daddy
I'm fight. Just saying.
I'm really uncomfortable right now.
You know, is the whole thing. You're going to find me. I'm going to be 85 years of age, and they're going to haul me out of my home, and you're going to see me on the Discovery Channel. They're going to go, it's the strangest thing. We went to the attic, and there's just nothing but half-consumed Filet-O-Fish meals. We have no idea where this came from. And then I'll just be, Don, you know, as they're strapping me to the gurney. It was just like, you know what it was? It was like an irresistible force, immovable object of OCD traits. Because you got the whole clean thing, which to some degree I do as well. Everybody has seen me. If you've been on the show, you've seen me. As soon as the show is done, I go through the studio and I clean and I tidy and I fold and I stack and I sort. I mean, during the show, it becomes really a disaster area. But once the show is done, everything goes away to looks like it hasn't quite been used yet. You know, it looks like it's like the instruction manual is still in everything because it's just brand new. I'm not that way necessarily in my, you know, like in my car or whatever, but in a common area, I am very, very exceptionally neat and tidy, really anal retentively so. So you have a little bit of that too. So that's your thing. My whole OCD thing though
about thinking that old bad food should go in the trash.
Well, about
that crazy OCD thing.
Well, I was going to be a little more pointed and say the tidying, even if it involves throwing away things that don't belong to you and that in fact belong to someone else. Not to put too fine a point on it, but my OCD, I cannot, except under the most extreme of circumstances, I cannot abide seeing food thrown away. It causes me almost physical pain to see people throw. And I don't mean like there's a scrap you could eat. I'm just talking about like, you know, if somebody gets halfway through something or it's like something has just been sitting for longer than they deem appropriate and just goes into the trash. And it just it gives me agita of just the most like intense variety. So we had a whole kind of collision.
If I may, I think that the problem here really more for me is your broad definition of the word food.
Well, there's a story behind the fact that there was a McRib here anyway. So it's longer than we have time for. But it was a... we had our 100th show, and it was a gift from Dawn, which, by the way, doesn't mean it still belonged to you because you gave it to me. So that's what gift means. I'm just saying, if we're going to be linguistically pure about the situation, I want to, you know.
It's hard to imagine a better gift.
Yeah, I mean, what's the gift that would have kept on giving? I mean, it's, you know, just giving.
For weeks and weeks and weeks.
Did I open the corpse watch?
You did.
It's this sort of, by the way, it's this sort of wry and amusing banter that the people pay the 32 cents a day for. I mean, it's really, it's like, you know, it's like you can't just sort of find this kind of wit laying around in the street. Here's Don Taylor with your corpse watch.
God, I don't even want to read the story now.
Yes, you do.
A 14-year-old girl with Down syndrome was left alone with her mother's corpse in their British Columbia trailer home for 9 days.
No.
See?
Oh, see, I didn't know that there was a Down syndrome and a girl and a 14, you know, in this. Usually it's just some guy who just, you know, is especially fond of the lady across the hall or something, and he's not going to let the cold hand of death get in the way of his love. All right. This is... Yes, no, we've... you were choosing... You chose correctly there. I chose poorly by asking you to continue.
There we go. So should I just stop
Please tell
now?
Me it's... Well, now I got to know. Please tell me it's a thing that the neighbors discovered because there was a stench.
Well, the girl's two older brothers are outraged at Vancouver, Canada, saying that their repeated warnings to the Ministry of Children and Family Development that their mother was unfit to care for the girl.
Oh, so it's not like she lived with somebody else. She just lived with the mom.
She lived with her mom in a trailer, and mom died of a drug overdose.
Oh, I see. So she's like parent of the year in many ways. Okay.
They had actually reported their mother to social services countless times for alcoholism, addiction to pills, including clonazepam and Ativan. And anyway, in July, one of the guys visited the trailer, which was, he described as being filthy and like an episode of Hoarders. Seeing its condition and their mother's condition, Kevin took his sister to his home and called police. They conducted a survey later in the month and told the brothers to return the girl.
It's good that she had multiple kids, by the way, you know, because that's how that always works out well for those folks. Well, not at all, just have more.
Yeah, the crazy drug addict mom was going to charge the older brothers with kidnapping for taking the Down syndrome girl out of the filthy trailer.
This is Canada, not Washington?
Weirdly enough, this was not...
Well, you can't get rid of the 14-year-old who's going to walk to the store to get smokes.
So on September 14th, a neighbor who realized he hadn't seen any activity at the trailer for a while peeked in through a window and said, one of the sons said, 2 months after we called social services saying we're worried our mom is going to harm herself and our sister's going to be left with a dead corpse, my mom passed away. Yvonne had been dead for 9 days and her body had begun to decompose.
Okay, there you go. That's awesome. You know, there's a lot to be said for running your country as a dictatorship. I mean, really. I'm just saying, like, someday when Rick Emerson is the grand, irremovable dictator of the world, things are going to operate a little bit differently in terms of who's allowed to reproduce multiple times.
Yes, multiple times.
All right, there's your corpse. Normally, the corpse watch just involves like a shovel and a guy who just felt a little bit lonely at home and saw a fetching.
Or a truck driver with a dead hooker that he said, hey, I'm just going to drive around with this until I find a dumpster.
Or in the case of those three guys from Wisconsin, an obituary photo that they found especially fetching. So, all right, there you go. There's your corpse watch for Thursday. I'm digging up home. See, it's the digging, and it's not even, the theme is not even really, it's not even technically accurate with the story. That's just disconcerting.
Well, you know, sometimes they take a right turn.
Do we do our taser watch?
No.
We should do that, and then we'll talk about CJ's, and then we'll release Anna Griffin and Mike Russell from this rather unique prison in which they've been ensconced for the last, like, 9 hours. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Real quickly, let me say this about that. The Rick Emerson Radio Program is made possible by a generous grant from y'all, as well as our many fine business partners, including the fine folks at CJ's High Climbing Services. Mike Russell, Anna Griffin, you guys seem responsible. Do you rent? Do you own? Can I ask?
Own.
All right. So you guys, do you have the gutters around your house?
We do have the gutters.
You have the gutters around your house. You got the leaves. You got the blowing. You got the clogging. The running over that happens. Does it seem to you occasionally that when the water runs out of your gutters because they get like, you know, they get the leaves packed in there, or they get like geraniums that sprout out of the middle or something, that it's like the water always cascades out in rivulets directly over the section of the porch under which you must walk to get to your car?
It's a conundrum, yeah.
It's like a planned obsolescence thing, right? It's like they've designed it just that way. Do you, Mike Russell, do you clamber up a ladder to the top of your home to get rid of that yourself?
I just did, in fact, and then there was ivy growing out of it. It was crazy.
That's what I'm saying. You never know what's there. That is my point. One never is aware of what might be lurking inside you got your gutter, you got your downspout thing. And then it's like that stuff grows halfway in to the downspout where it's like there's no way to... You know, it's not like you can x-ray it. There's no way to figure out what's in there. And so the only way you know that something is amiss is that everything just starts gurgling out of the top. And by that point, whatever's in the middle clogging it has been there for so long that it started to decay. And then it's like it's just going to be like a Spirito Fest if you get into there. And it's like you don't want to do that because then it's like they're...
There could be snakes.
Yeah, there could be snakes, and then it's like they're just you know, wrapping your whole house in the plastic like you're de-stone, and you're trying to get out, and it ends poorly. You don't want to do any of these things, you know. And God forbid, it's like you climb up onto the ladder, and then it's like somebody in the house, perhaps somebody who loves you, says, "Hey, would you like some hot chocolate?" And then you say yes, and you reach down, but you don't have like your you know, it's like you've been walking around all day with those socks that have the rubber on the bottom that's the traction and the tread. And so you've forgotten about the fact that maybe not everything has that much adhesion or purchase on it. You put on your regular shoes, you turn to get the hot chocolate that has the marshmallows on top, not the big one, but the tiny little ones. And then you lose your center of gravity and then you plummet to the ground. And then there's no more hot chocolate for you, just pureed spinach fed to you through a straw. All because you didn't call CJ's High Climbing. That is cjshighclimbing.com. That's the website for them at 503-228-9278. 503-228-9278. And we just mentioned Cheryl Kanakoa, our chief of staff, a minute ago. She actually called us this morning right before we started Legion of News to say that she had looked out as she's like in a townhouse. And she's way the hell out. I don't even know if it's still Beaverton. I mean, I really, honestly, there's some town beyond there. It's not Hillsboro. It's like some...
Hillsboro is beyond Beaverton.
But it's like some other... Because I asked her once, I said, do you live in Hillsboro? And she did that. No. But it was like some... You know, it was just some weird place, like, wasn't even on a map or whatever. But it was, you know, she lives in, like, some, you know...
Damascus?
Maybe.
Banks?
Sure. I don't know.
How long has she worked for you?
Well, it's not like I go... I mean, I've a long time, but so.
You don't know where she lives.
No, why would I? I mean, it's, you know...
You gave him a McRib for the 100th show.
I know.
You know, I'm just with. Look,
I know where you live.
Yeah, but it's not like I've invited you to come over or anything. I mean, it's you know, I believe that happy relationships have a little bit of distance there. There's a you know, a little bit of. I'm just saying. Well, this has gone in a direction I didn't intend, but she called before the show to say she was looking at the window. She's like, the CJ's High Climbing Services truck. It's like, the guys are right there. So it's not like they just work inside the city limits of Portland. You know, it's not like they're just, you know, like in downtown or in just the sort of, you know, the more heavily trafficked suburban areas. They'll go to wherever the job needs to be done. So if it's gutter cleaning or whether it's cleaning the downspout, as we mentioned before, they can actually give you, in most cases, they can give you an estimate ahead of time via Google Earth. So you give them the address, they go online, they look, and they go, oh, I see your problem. Because you get people who get the leak in the ceiling and they don't realize that there is algae or mold that has grown to the point that it is literally pushing these shingles apart on the roof.
Google Earth, they can just look at the top of your house via satellite.
They can just,
because we live in the future.
They can look down and they can say, I see your... It's like one of those stories where the guy is doing like a tonsillectomy from Malaysia, you know, or via fiber optic lines or something. Then they come to your house, they can invoice you, you know, after the fact, so you don't have to take time off from work. It's not like you have to stick around to watch a guy climb a ladder and down like 50 times. So if you've got, you know, maybe your house or maybe an elderly relative or somebody in your family, you just don't want them screwing with that, you call 503-228-9278 or go to cjshighclimbing.com. Be sure to tell me you heard it right here on the Emerson News Network. CJ's High Climbing, proud sponsor of this, the Rick Emerson radio program.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
I'm sorry, Mike Russell, were you just actually raising your hand to speak in the studio?
That was. I just want to say that will go down as the standard by which I hold all sponsor reads henceforth ever. That was epic. Maestro.
Can I get you to put that in writing?
Yes.
All right. Excellent. You know, it's like Aaron Mesh, I think, yesterday. Didn't he, like, raising his hand to say goodbye or something? And
yeah,
he
waved goodbye to us and then had to say he was waving because he then realized he was on the radio.
I thought he was raising his hand to ask a question. And then I thought, well, that's silly. No one would do that. Mike Russell, it's your first visit to the studio, though, so...
I'm in there with Court and Fatboy. That's how I get a word in edgewise.
No, here we just... that's what we told Anna Grunz. Like, you know, the first time you're here, you just got to, like, you know, you got to learn just to jam those comments in, because if you're waiting for me to stop speaking, that is...
The man does not breathe.
No, it's going to be a bit before that happens. All right, we'll do the Taser Watch. We'll have a few final questions for Mr. Mike Russell, and then we'll let everybody be on their merry way. This is your Taser Watch for Thursday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. This is Don Taylor with your Taser Watch for Thursday.
This Taser Watch is especially for you, Rick Emerson, and you will know why, because this is something that you have dreamed of actually happening, and it is coming true. Some law enforcement agencies in Florida have...
In where?
Florida. Have added cameras to their Taser units. The tiny camera sits in the Taser's pistol-like grip. Police say the Taser cams help them show what actually...
Oh, man, I'm literally drooling. Hold on. Okay. That is... Really?
Yes.
You're not just... This isn't like your opposite day where you're screwing with me. You're going to dangle this and snatch it away.
It is very true.
And of course, it's Florida. That's so glorious.
Police say the Taser cams help them...
Taser cam! It's called a Taser cam! God, I love this country.
The cameras help us prove things in court, said Winter Park, Florida.
And by prove, they mean...
John Aspen.
By prove, they mean show, and by things, they mean that the guy was asking for it. That's what that is cop for he was asking for it.
The question of whether a person tries to resist arrest or not is often a matter of the officer's word against the suspects. But police say the cameras show the moments leading up to the Taser's use. In one case, the camera shows a man yank the Taser's wires out and continue to flee, even when shocked over and over again. Authorities also say the cameras also can help protect them against false brutality claims by those arrested, and also as well as protect citizens from excessive force. This has audio and video, so we'll see who's right, said Askins.
That is... You have made me so happy with this story. This is really just one of the best things I have ever heard in my life. Is this starting now? Is this going to be widely distributed?
According to Taser's website, a study found that when video of an incident was available, the video exonerated officers of any wrongdoing more than 96% of the time.
Look, because let's be honest. I mean, it's like everybody's had a bad experience with a cop, and everybody, you know, there are bad apples who ruin the image of law enforcement. But let's be honest. 90% of people are just, you know, and I don't just mean 90% of people like who get pulled over or detained. I mean 90% of people are asking for a tasing. Like at some point during the day, you know it's true. I mean it's like you've been behind some, you know, some jackass at the post office. Who's, you know, he's just sitting there. I don't know. Do I want Bugs Bunny stamps or do I want, you know, Heroes of the West stamps? You're just like, oh, that guy needs a tasing. There are people who really just they're screaming for it. And so this is fantastic. Also, just real quickly, the other great thing about this is if they can figure out a way then they make these videos watchable online, either live or like later, and then they can charge for it, think about the revenue the state could bring in if you could do, if you'd like pay $3.99 a month or whatever and just watch just bastards get tased left and right. Oh, that'd be awesome.
The only thing that would be better is if they actually put the camera on the barb as it flew towards them like a cruise missile, you know?
A true taser
sort of
cam.
Right into the guy. Ah, it's wonderful. Thank you, Don Taylor.
You're welcome.
That's right. There you go. That's what I call a taser watch. Fantastic.
You got me running, going out of my mind. I can't do it for you. You got me thinking that I'm wasting my time. Don't taste me, bro.
Mike Russell had apparently never heard the Taser Watch sound.
Oh, that's one of our favorite sounders.
That's beautifully.
It really, it's a. it really is just a thing of astonishing beauty, isn't it? It's it never. And the thing is, it never gets old. I've heard it 1,000 times.
I'd be laughing at that 2 years from now.
Yeah. Well, it's like the Geek Watch, which I actually can't take credit for. The Geek Watch was created by a listener. We had a contest to create the Geek Watch sounder, and the Geek Watch was created by. And I apologize, and I'll say this, and then he'll email me because every time I forget it, he emails me. He's like, "I'm the guy who created the Geek Watch," but it's like. You know, it's just fantastic.
Would you do me one quick quit?
Do you a kindness?
Yeah. Would you play the Clown Watch sound for?
Oh, here's the. Have you not heard the Clown Watch? Do you share a fear of clowns?
Don and I are a little terrified.
Coulrophobics?
Yeah.
Here's the Clown Watch theme, by the way.
I'm busting out in hives.
It goes on for 3 minutes, by the way, and it changes keys twice.
Oh, no.
Okay.
This is, if you unscrew the top of my head, that's the music that comes out.
Does that segue into the serial killer quiz?
No. Sadly, I was not prepared for that eventuality. I will tell you that every time, and I've now made these dreams come true, by the way, every time we play that, we would get emails from people going like, is that downloadable? Because I want to make that. Sometimes it's like the ringtone for an ex. It's like the, but the thing is, it's
some guy
never.
Going, I really want to scare my wife.
That's the thing is, it's never a ringtone or a sound for themselves. It's always because they want to like spring it on a guy that's terrified of clowns. So you can download that, by the way, in the archive section at rickemerson.com.
I take great pleasure in on Twitter linking scary clown news just specifically to Dawn. Like, Dawn, look at this. And then it'll be like 700 clowns laughing simultaneously in Central America.
As I think I've mentioned to you, I might have mentioned this on Outlook Portland, not here. When I worked with Mike at a newspaper, he and our coworker David Stroop would enjoy finding things that terrified and disturbed me and then putting them on my computer as a screensaver.
Well done.
So that when I would come into work the next morning and turn on my computer, there would be a nutria or a really terrifying clown, and it would be the first thing I saw when I turned my computer on.
It's odd that clowns and nutria occupy the same sort of phobic space in your brain. Incidentally,
they both drool.
We do not have the serial killer game here, unfortunately, but I'll bring it to but on the front, John Wayne Gacy. There you go. Just sort of a big cartoonish kind of a... as we prepare to wrap up the program, we're here with Mr. Mike Russell. You can read his writings and so forth at culturepulp.com. So we're going to give you the Rick Emerson Show guest. I forget what we actually even called it. I was going to call it a questionnaire, but I think that's what Lipton actually calls his thing. And let's be honest.
That's the Proust questionnaire. This could be the Emerson questionnaire.
I was trying to just make the theft at least somewhat less obvious by not putting the word questionnaire, which I then obviate by noting every time that I've stolen it from Lipton. But he stole it from, you know,
from Proust.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm, you know, as prepared for blah, blah, you know, the guy. And he says that he has the whole intro that he does.
Can I pretend I'm, like, doing my doer's profile just so I get get my suave
yes.
on? Yeah, okay.
If you'd like, you can also do this. You can imagine your face as the three black and white photos at the bottom of the Playboy interview, you know?
Would you like a shot of whiskey while you do this? We got a little Pendleton's, I think, still left of the bottle over there.
Pipe and an eye light, please.
I believe we have some, I think we have some Kahlua that's been open for, like, a month. Do we still have that?
No, they finally threw that. No, Sarah and Greg finally threw that away.
Threw it into their stomachs. All right, so we have the brief question here from Mr. Mike Russell. Number one, what is your favorite currently airing television program?
Oh, boy.
boy.
Venture Brothers.
What album or artist is on your iPod or in your stereo right now?
And Anna Monoguchi's soundtrack to the Scott Pilgrim video game.
Wow.
Nerd!
Okay.
I guess this just stopped being a doer's profile really quick.
Yeah.
You know.
Venture Brothers, Scott Pilgrim game. There's the serial killer game right behind you, by the way.
Oh, really? Is it lurking in the corner?
Hold on. Let me just. Oh, yep. So it is. Well spotted. Hold on. It's, there you go.
Oh, my God.
It's got a cartoon Gacy on the front on a cartoon playground with a knife.
With two children
medicine
in the background.
Small
just
children.
Yeah. Just reading, just playing in the park, not knowing they're about to be stabbed by a clown.
We'll bust this out the next time you're here. We'll,
Oh, that's all right, Rick. It's already burned into my retinas for all time.
Rick Emerson cares.
I want you to have a full experience.
If it makes me any cooler, I also have some Sinatra and Mel Torme on that iPod. No, that's not cool either.
Well, this is, you know, like, this is the point where if Aaron Duran were here, we'd be like, and we're all married. It's amazing, you know. Let's see. Number three. The best television finale you have ever seen is?
Oh, God. We'll see. It's going to be another nerd answer. Cowboy Bebop.
You know, you don't really have to give that preface to things here.
Yeah,
you can just sort of...
Yeah, no. The ending of Cowboy Bebop is remarkably satisfying.
That's a thing. And see, that's a ship that sailed without me. It's just a thing that I missed almost entirely was Cowboy Bebop.
I'm not even a particularly big anime fan, and I love the Cowboy Bebop, which is why it was my Rick Emerson.
Yeah, I'm not an anime guy either. That show stands alone.
Yeah.
So it's a thing I should be watching.
You should. Well, it's
worth checking out.
No, but I mean, I can power load it now,
right? It came
and
went. Yeah. Yeah, it's all been done.
But it's viewable. Like, I can get it all.
Yeah.
So, all right. Because I'm trying to, you know, I got that whole thing where I'm trying to catch up, you know, on stuff that I did. I just missed, like, the first time around or whatever. Like, I did that whole thing last December. Where I watched, like, five seasons of House in, like, a week or something. So.
And the soundtrack to Cowboy Bebop also stands alone as just exemplary music.
Hey, whatever happened to Samurai Jack?
I don't know.
It was like it was on, and then it was just then
that's
it was
Genndy
not.
That's Tarkovsky,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's working on some new projects now. Yeah.
Let's see, Mr. Mike Russell. What is the food you eat when no one is around?
Scotch. No, I don't know.
Okay. There's nothing. There's no shame food.
Oh, there's shame food.
Well, then what is it?
Oh, jeez.
I'm just saying, like you got the house to yourself, or there's nobody's watching, and you say, "Oh, the ready whip into the mouth," or whatever.
Well, you know, I break out the kettle corn.
Really? Is that your honest answer?
I think so.
That's the most shameful thing you eat that you try to, like, you wait till, like, you're alone in the house
with
to do
frosting on it.
All right, fine. No, look, whatever. If that's your answer, it's your answer. But, I mean, I'm just saying, it's most people, they dig a little deeper into the back of the cupboard, you know, where there's, like, the bookcase that slides aside, and you reach inside, and there's...
Yeah, I believe Annie Griffin's was it chips and salsa or something like that?
Over the sink.
Over the sink.
Yeah,
yeah,
like in the middle of the night. Like, no, I'm just feeding the dog.
What was the Del Taco noise? That noise.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's... And with me, it is one of two things. It is either... It is either Triscuits with, like, the spray cheese on top, you know, the extrudable cheese, or just, like, an entire box of Crunch and Munch, just at a sitting.
Crunch and Munch, man, it's been a while.
What is the first live concert you ever attended?
Oh, my God. You know, honestly, because of my upbringing, it was probably some contemporary Christian artist. I don't remember.
Did you grow up in you must have grown up in a strongly Christian household then.
I grew up in a very Christian household, and it was probably some contemporary
Christian
band.
Going to see Petra.
I did, in fact, see Petra
awesome.
Live as a young man.
Good for you.
Yes.
Well done. Did you have any, do you have any odd or excessive rituals or behaviors?
Yes.
One will suffice for now if you'd like to tell us what it is.
Excessive rituals or behaviors.
And see, in this again, it's like you either have them or you don't, and if you have them, you know. You don't have to think about it.
I know Mike is the type, though, that has them, though, because I worked with him, and I used to watch him. He's a very ritualistic person.
I'll give you an example. For example, when Sarah Dillon is eating loose food, like, let's say, M&Ms or Skittles or popcorn or something, she has to have an equal number of items on either side of her mouth. Two M&Ms on the left, two M&Ms on the right, that kind of a thing.
I actually have a weird thing about keeping all my food separated. That would be one. I also always had to have a little die-cast toy from my childhood by my desk while I write or draw.
What happens if it's not there?
The words, they don't come.
All right. Let's see. See, the thing about when we have answers like that, it just makes me feel like Dawn and I are, in fact, just crazy. That it's not like we're just the representative examples of a larger swath of humanity.
I will tell you one. I used to be a little more, slightly more OCD than I am now, and there was a period in my youth when I got really, I would always have to triple check the envelope to make sure I put everything in it before I sealed it.
That
because
counts.
Of the finality of sealing the envelope, I became paranoid that I had not put everything in it, and I would often check that past the point of evidentiary truth.
Okay, no, that counts. See, that totally, but you don't do it anymore.
Are you, no, I got right. over that. All are right. you entertained by my nuttiness now?
I'm just saying not everybody, you know, what I don't want is for you to, you know, just feel like you have to dig around for something that kind of fits, because some people, as we've learned, just don't have, like, I think it was Dave Schmidtke or somebody we were interviewing one time, and he was just like relentlessly normal. He just had like no weirdness to him whatsoever, and he's like, I don't know, I like to brush my teeth before I go to bed every night. And it was just like he just had no craziness. Ryan White has none of these either. He has no bizarre OCD traits, at least that he would say.
Here's what I would argue. I think that what people in answering these questions are always looking for are their air ready wackinesses. they're not pulling out the really dark stuff that nobody knows about.
We have kind of an elastic sense of what is permissible for broadcast.
Okay.
Let's see. Approaching the end of the questionnaire from Mr. Mike Russell from culturepulp.com. What is the mistake in grammar, language, or pronunciation which most annoys you?
Nuclear.
Well done. What is your favorite Yiddish word?
Schmutta.
What is
I don't think that's actually a Yiddish word, by the way. I just like the word schmutta.
Is that a thing you've just fabricated in your head? Is like a
No, it's just a word. It's a word that I use in everyday speech.
Is that a Mike Russell original, or is that a mangling?
I feel like I've heard
Yiddish
it somewhere,
word.
and I liked it.
And
maybe
use it in a sentence.
There's some schmutta all over the table.
No, you're thinking of schmutz.
Schmutz.
Yeah.
Oh, well, see, I clearly heard bad. I heard some mispronounced Yiddish and internalized it as actual Yiddish.
I was going to go to the judges in the back, the judges being Anna Griffin, because she knows the Yiddish. She can bring it. Schmutz. Yeah.
But it's Yiddish, so that's probably a word, and probably means penis.
That really is true. Let's see. Number nine?
I've been saying there's penis all over my table for the last... oh, man.
Indeed. You should keep those die-cast toys away from that.
Yeah.
Do you love the movie Showgirls?
Yes. And I don't even think I love it ironically.
Good for you.
I actually think... Dawn and I are actually on the same page on this. We sort of admire it as a trash classic. In this much the same way I actually unironically like Roadhouse.
3/4 of the room, we're all on the same page there. It's the same way, you know what, it's the same way that I like Varsity Blues, you know, where it's awful, but it's like sort of great.
Your life. Yeah,
exactly.
Roadhouse and a 60s Technicolor Howard Hawks Western are more alike than they are different.
Final question, the bumper sticker which most irritates you is?
Oh my God, well, any bumper sticker, frankly. I don't believe that your any bumper sticker on the back of an automobile is a substitute for actual expression. If you feel like you need to put that on your car to seem wacky, then you actually probably are trying too hard.
If you don't have your own wit, just buy someone else's
right.
wit for $1.99.
Right, I'm very allergic to that, yes.
Well done. All right, I approve. Mr. Mike Russell, you can read him in print in the Oregonian online at culturepulp.com. Anna Griffin can read her as well in print in the Oregonian. What is coming up in the Oregonian that folks should be aware of, Anna Griffin?
Oh, on Saturday I'm writing about a big debate in the Woodstock neighborhood of Southeast Portland about whether to replace a nasty abandoned Arby's with a 7-Eleven.
Where at, if I can ask?
Woodstock and 52nd.
I know exactly where that is. So they're talking about replacing it with a what?
A 7-Eleven.
All right, then. And that is in Saturday's Oregonian.
Saturday's Oregonian.
Reader in print in the Oregonian, online at OregonLive.com. Anna Griffin, Mike Russell, thank you guys for putting up with our juvenile foolishness today. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Mr. Big Jim Willig. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, from where all good things derive. At the news desk, it is Dawn Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill. Executive producer is Bruce Agler, and of course, our chief of staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show made possible in part by a generous grant from y'all. Thank you for listening. It is Thursday, November 11th, 2010, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, after a brief musical interlude, an encore of today's Legion of News broadcast, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. Thank you for listening. Be safe. See y'all tomorrow. Bye now.